Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinny Eastwood Show, being done completely without video, because despite the fact that you pay for Skype group frickin' video, you can't do group frickin' video, which means I'm going to have to ask for my money back from those scum. I mean, look at it this way. Bill Gates doesn't need my money. Why would he take it without offering me a service in exchange? That's frickin' annoying. Anyway, today, ladies and gentlemen, I might be a bit sleep-deprived and have a bit of a short fuse, as you might have told already, might be able to tell already. And my very special guests are Stu Webb and CIA whistleblower Chip Tatum. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Vinny. Good to be here.
Thank you, Vinny, for having us again.
It's about as close to a mind control program as you can get on talk radio. So, we would like to get a wee bit of an introduction and background on the both of you for those who don't know. So, Stu, let's quickly start with you. Just tell us a little bit about who you are, what you do.
Well, I'm a federal whistleblower, been one since 1988. Caused four congressional investigations back-to-back, the HUD scandal of 1989, the Silverado scandal, the Denver International Airport scandal, and what they called the Keating 5/MDC 200. Yeah, Colorado State's biggest case, but it ended up the Keating 5. But those were all congressional investigations. Since then, I've been after Crime Syndicate, which is my ex-in-law that controls AIPAC, which is Daddy Bush's partner. I think that says it all.
Are they AIPAC of liars?
Pardon me?
AIPAC of liars? Is that why they call it AIPAC?
Yeah, AIPAC of liars, you're right. AIPAC, the Israeli Mossad that overthrew America, American-Israeli pact.
You know, there's a reason why they call them Mossad, because they ain't there to make you more happy.
No, they aren't. They aren't. They don't make anybody happy. But I married the daughter of an Illuminati 12, Daddy Bush's, and Meyer Rothschild, and Henry Kissinger, and David Rockefeller, and Anwar bin Sharia of Israel, and all the 12 of them. I married the daughter of one of them. They took my kid from me illegally, and after she tried to murder our daughter, and here I am 30 years later, and with lifetime restraining orders out of an illegal second court where they said they paid me off and to go away, sealed for life, can't open the case until I get some justice. There's no justice in America. So here I am still today out here yelling and screaming, exposing them, and probably will be until the day I die.
That's why they call it the criminal justice system, because they're just criminals.
That's all they are.
Yeah. Okay, Chip Tatum, your story, background, please.
I have a little history. 20 years working for the United States government. I started my government service in the Air Force as a in special operations as a combat controller. Served in Vietnam. Served in Grenada, served in Cambodia, served as a special ops pilot in the 160th Aviation. A lot of people, you might know those. That group is the guys that flew in to get Osama bin Laden with the broken helicopter. I was a pilot with that group. And in later years, after 1986, I worked for the operational subgroups, which were directed by National Reconnaissance Office and the Vice President of the United States.
Anything further on top of that?
No, nothing more than that.
It's just your service, and then that's it. You know, are you still a member of the government? You know.
Oh no, they don't have enough money for me to work for them. once they charged me with treason, that was enough.
Okay. Well, what happens to you when you get charged with treason? How are you still here?
Well, I'll tell you what happens to you. They throw you in a deep, dark cell and forget you're there. I was on underground in Florence, Colorado, in Supermax, put on diesel therapy where I wasn't. When they traveled me around the United States, media was trying to get a hold of me. I wasn't in the same place for more than a day so that I couldn't get on telephones to advise anyone where I was. The U.S. Marshals would pick me up at 4 in the morning, drop me off at 11 at night, going from city to city to city jail for 6 months.
I think that's one of the part of the mind control programs, I think, is they try to disorient and to destroy you, keep you away from family, contacts, things of that nature, so that you feel completely alone and that you've got no hope kind of thing. Is that what they were doing to you?
Yeah, trying to break you. Uh-huh. It's the MO for that. They couldn't do it. Taking me from jail to jail was like having chauffeurs and having room service when I was in solitary. So,
and why did they charge you with treason exactly? What did you do?
I had in earlier years working for the government, doing the nefarious deeds that we were doing, flying drugs, doing assassinations. I had collected a lot of information to protect myself, and having seen what happened to others. And when I walked away from the OSGs in 1992, the day I walked away is the day they asked us to neutralize Ross Perot, get him out of the election. And that's just not the way we do business. But that's the way Bush wanted it done. And so I walked away and I told him I had my insurance policy. I gave him a copy of what I'd collected through the years. And I put those copies in 8 places around the world. In the event of my death, they were to be brought out to the media. They told me to give them all those copies or I'd be charged with treason and placed in jail, probably put to death. I said, let's dance. I didn't think they could do it, but I'll be darned, they sure did.
Yeah, it's not exactly a pleasant experience to know that the people you've been working for all this time just suddenly turn on you, is it?
Well, but you see it. You know, I had predecessors. They did the same. We had people we'd fly that worked with them, people, you know, the Iran-Contra leaders that crossed them. It was our job to go in and take them out. We did. Other leaders around the world that crossed Reagan and Bush, it was our job to take them out, and we did. So we knew they would have no qualms about coming against one of us. We're just a throwaway. Just
a loose end.
Right.
Well, could you then divulge? Who were you assassinating?
Well, we assassinated one of the Iran-Contra leaders, a man named Enrique Bermudez. He was in 1990, Nicaragua, decided to hold free elections. They had elections, and a woman named Chamorro came in as the new president. He wanted a high position. She thought he was too gruff to work in her administration, and he threatened the administration that if he didn't get placed in a high position, he'd turn over all the information, all of the drugs that they were making in their Contra camps in Nicaragua and sending to the U.S. They couldn't have that, so he was taken down. Walking outside of the Intercontinental Hotel in 1991, he was shot.
Now, what's interesting is that just last night, not 8 hours ago, I just got off doing a 3-hour interview with Ole Damegaard, who was telling me about the template by which the New World Order has teams of assassins to go in. How many people were in your team, and how many teams were there at the time? He said that they were usually between 3 and 4 teams of 3 that would come in, and they would be the assassins that would come in about maybe a couple of weeks to a month after the initial surveillance teams would come in, identify the target, get all their habits down, and then set up a shooting position, that kind of thing.
If shooting was the mode, yes. We had four OSG teams, operational subgroups that worked under the Terrorist Incident Working Group from the National Security Council. We received our orders directly from the White House. The size of the teams would vary, to be honest, depending upon the mission. If it was a straight assassination, we wouldn't go in heavy. If it was an intimidation or neutralization or blackmail, we've flown computer geniuses around the world. They've gone in, they've hacked banks, taken money from congressmen in foreign nations or parliament in foreign nations, moved money out to neutralize them, get them to vote the way that they want or get them to do what they wanted to. So just depended on the mission. But normally no more than about, I'd say the heaviest mission we had was 6 people.
Yeah. But probably like average of three, one shooter, one driver, one spotter.
And one to take care of business if they failed.
A cleanup guy kind of thing.
Exactly.
And how long had you been doing this? You said you've been working for the U.S. government for a good 20 years.
Sure. I started in 1970 as a young military man. Then I was recruited across and sheep-dipped and placed in with the Defense Intelligence Agency, worked for them, worked for the CIA, worked for the, as I said, National Security Council, worked for Ollie North. He was my boss.
Really? Was yes, Ollie sir. A nice guy in person? And did he give you any of his gold?
Ollie was a dipshit. You know, here's a guy, Mr. Blood and Guts from Vietnam. Now, he was heavily awarded and everything, but he lost it over the years. We went into one Contra camp, and there was a lot of blood flowing, and we'd flown in a medevac helicopter from Honduras into Nicaragua. There was a lot of blood flowing, and he got weak knees and fell out on us. So Mr. Blood and Guts, the brave Marine colonel, got a little too money hungry.
Well, how much did he make away with, do you reckon?
Oh, I'd say over $100 million. I know during his Senate campaign, back in those days, the reward is that they'll run you for a congressional seat, a Senate seat. And in his campaign, anything he didn't spend, he got to keep. And the PACs boosted him with millions and millions of dollars that he only spent like $1.5 million on his campaign and got to keep everything else. Didn't have any intention of winning.
All you do is convert it to personal income when you're a candidate and declare a tax on it.
Right. And then there's the Enterprise. Look, the Enterprise sold drugs, they sold arms, they sold aircraft, they sold uranium, they sold everything. I know the deal with uranium was over $1 billion with the Iranians, selling illegal uranium to them out of a South African mine that the British owned. So he got a piece of it, there's no doubt. He was right up there in the cabal, right on top.
We can't forget, Vinny. Is our current ongoing Pier 66 Miami drug operation involving his submarine company that brings cocaine in from Colombia and different places in Central America, packed in ice, and lands at Jeb Bush's operation there at Pier 66 with Jeb Bush and, I might add, Roger Moore, the gun shop owner and the Oklahoma City bombing. He's got his three yachts coming in there weekly full of cocaine and other drugs. That's the Texaco refinery, by the way, on Pier 66.
Okay. Well, what is it that you guys would like to really... what's the direction you guys would like to take this conversation today? Because really, you can take it anywhere.
Well, why don't we let Chip do most of the conversation here, because he is not that known. He did a lot of radio shows with me. As a co-guest, we did them together. I kind of introduced him into the Patriot world, as I'm doing now. And then after that, he did hundreds of shows. If you remember the cocaine trafficking in the United States back in the 1990s, mid-90s.
And, you mean Whitewater or Clinton's kind of involvement?
Well, he was involved there, too. And I think it's good to question him here. And I'll kind of co-host with you as far as a few questions, because I know Gene well, but back in the mid-90s, Maxine Waters, Congressman Maxine Waters of California, we got her riled all up about the illegal Bush cocaine coming in, CIA trafficking in the U.S., and Gary Webb was writing a series of stories in the Jose Mercury Press, which ended up later wrote his book. So Gene,
whose bloody phone is that?
Gene was his source on that, and it later got Gary Webb murdered when he came out with his book, Suicide, you know, on the type deals. But, Gene, you want to start with maybe your Vietnam experience and tell us about Mr. Rambo, Gene Chip Tatum in Cambodia? Maybe start there.
He doesn't even appear to be there at the moment. Oh,
that's right at the beginning.
There's another thing. We have 3 hours. I'm not sure if you guys are aware of this, and we're only 15 minutes into the interview thus far. So don't leave out any details by any means.
Okay, I was we'll start right at the beginning. I was recruited, actually not recruited, in 1970. The United States had a thing called the draft. And if you were in a religious, you could get, let me see, what was there? There was physical disabilities, you would stay out of the draft. For religious reasons, you could stay out of the draft. And for a university, you could stay out of the draft. I was in university at the time, but I made an F on one of my classes in chemistry. I forgot to go to the lab classes. Did fine, made an A in my classroom, but didn't go to any lab classes. I didn't even know they existed. And so the draft board got the notice that I had flunked out on a chemistry exam, and I got a notice in the mail. We want you to come report. So I reported to the draft office. And there sitting were all the recruiters for the United States military. There was the Air Force, there was Army, there was Marines, there was Navy. And I went to each one of them. And the Marines, I knew I didn't want to go with them. They were just kind of nuts. The Army, I knew if I went to the Army, they'd be going to Vietnam. The Navy didn't look bad now. They had the bell-bottom jeans and the Cambry shirts, if you remember those days in the 70s. But going out on ships all the time, I didn't care for that idea. When I saw the Air Force recruiter, he said, look, even if you do go to Vietnam, what we'll do for you is we're going to make you an air traffic controller. So you'll be 100 miles away from any of the enemy lines, sitting in an air-conditioned air traffic control tower, controlling all these aircraft coming in and out. And when you get out, you'll have a good job. I bought it. Hook, line, and sinker. So I went to Keesler Air Force Base January 1970, graduated in the top of the class, 12 weeks later. And, next thing I knew, the top 10% of the class was sent to jump school in Georgia. We went to jump school. We went from, jump school to C survival school to escape and evasion, and after that, we went to diving school, and then the next thing I know, I was shipped off to Southeast Asia. We were in a brand new career field called the combat controllers. Now, if you can imagine, you've seen the movies, the enemies in one area, the friendly militaries in the other area, and to make sure that the jets coming in at 600-800 miles an hour don't drop on the wrong people. They dropped us with parachutes in between the two to call in the airstrikes. That's the combat controller. Additionally, we worked as forward air controllers when not jumping and going up in aircraft, calling in the airstrikes on the enemy, and in a slow prop job, just floating up there, getting ready, waiting to get shot. We could take on small arms fire or anti-aircraft rounds up there. We weren't that high. While I was in Thailand, I was stationed in Thailand in support of a group called Task Force Alpha. Task Force Alpha was the supporting entity for a civilian group, working in Cambodia and Laos called Air America. When those aircraft would go down, we would have the job of jumping in, picking up the, crypto gear on board the aircraft. Any pilots left alive or crew members left alive, we'd extract them, and then any valuable cargo they might have on board, we'd extract that. I'm going to tell you, folks, Air America flew a lot of rice, and that rice was in bricks, in those big sacks, and we extracted a lot of those bricks of rice out of both Cambodia and Laos. While I was there, there was a special operations team being put together that I didn't know about. Apparently Nixon administration had decided that to get out of the war, they needed to get the Cambodians involved with the South Vietnamese. That was the only way that the Americans could leave and South Vietnam to have a chance against the North Vietnamese. Unfortunately, Lon Nol, the premier of Cambodia, was a fence setter. He was getting money from the U.S. and arms from the U.S. he was also getting money in arms from China. The money in arms from China he was using to help, he was getting to help support the Viet Cong in his, that would come up and hide and arm themselves and train in his country. And the money from the United States he would use to fight with a group of rebels within his country against his government called the Khmer Rouge. So he was very happy getting all that money, all those arms from both sides, without having to make a move one way or another. It was decided that what had to happen is the North Vietnamese had to make a move on him and cause him to want more support from the United States. Well, it just wasn't happening. They were very happy with what was going on. So Washington decided to put a false flag up. They decided to put a special forces unit together, go in, blow up the Phnom Penh airport, leaving bodies of Viet Cong around, and sneak out. There was a 14-man contingency put together, training just for that mission. And unfortunately, the Camo guy of the special forces unit had broken his leg in one of the practice jumps. And I was one of the in the area of operations, one of the people that had experience with square canopy jumps instead of round canopies. So I was pulled in, and we jumped in. We pulled off the mission. We dropped the sappers, North Vietnamese sappers. We killed them, left them in various points around the airport. Got to our extraction point after a day, and no one ever came. So we sat there and we waited, and we got on the radios and we called, and no one answered. Come to find out, Nixon ordered that there's no way that we were to be picked up. No one could ever know that the United States went in and pulled off that mission against our allies. What it did, it was very successful. Within days, the United States was called by the Lon Nol administration and asked to come in. We already had ships and aircraft offshore waiting to go in. Within days, they had mounted a full regiment in Cambodia, and they had Marines, they had Air Force, Army, they had the works in there. We were subsequently captured. There were only 13 of us because one had been shot. We were subsequently captured, we were in the encampment a couple of weeks, being tortured, being questioned. Why were we dressed in Viet Cong clothes when you're obviously not Viet Cong? What are you doing here? Where did you come from? Who are you? We wouldn't answer. Not one word came out of our mouths. I did happen to know some Spanish words, so I spoke to him in Spanish. But that's the only thing that any of us ever said. We were lucky. Marine Recon Patrol, who had been brought in after the request of Lon Nol to help clean up the area because we weren't that far outside of Phnom Penh. This patrol happened to walk up on the encampment where we were held. They got in a firefight with our captors. They won, and those of us that were left alive were able to come out alive. I was wounded. My first sergeant was wounded. I'd been extracted to a hospital in the Philippines in Clark Air Force Base. But we were the only two that left alive. I was in a coma for 2 weeks. When I came out of my coma a couple days later, the man who called and briefed the mission, a man by the name of Colby, who later became the Director of Central Intelligence, told me that Washington had decided that they needed to keep me close to make sure that I didn't talk about this. He expressed to me the need for silence on the whole thing. And I didn't have a problem with that. So he said, now you have a choice. You can come. We'd like you to come across to the CIA. But if you really want to, you can stay with the Air Force, but you'll be under control of the Defense Intelligence Agency. So, I didn't want to go back to I didn't even want to go to the CIA. Those guys, they're the ones who caused us the problem to begin with. So I accepted to continue in the Air Force and work under control of the Defense Intelligence Agency. From that time until 1978, when I decided to leave the service, I was under their control and did various missions around the world. Italy, Yugoslavia, Argentina, Bolivia. In 1978, Ambassador Colby was leaving. He was DCI Colby at the time. He was leaving, and he contacted me and said, "Son, you need to think about getting out because I can't be around to protect you any longer." I said, "All right, you're on." I got out, went to the mountains of Colorado to live because there's great skiing and hunting up there. And I wasn't out 6 months before some men in their sunglasses and black jackets came in, explained to me that I was being reactivated into the United States Army this time. They sent me to Fort Rucker, Alabama. We went to a special flight training, and from there to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, where we picked up and started flying for the 160th. I was attached to as a little bird pilot. A little bird is the, if you guys know, it's the old Hughes 500, the one that Magnum PI flew around in, except these were very, very heavily armed. And that's in a nutshell, up through 1983, what I did.
And could you tell us how you got out of this and precisely the story that exactly happened to you, like in painstaking detail, preferably?
Yeah, I imagine.
Well, and also I understand that going back through memories like this, going through past traumas and things like that, a lot of these emotions and things will come up, and I'm sensitive to that. So, you know,
sure.
whatever you feel.
The VA was nice. They gave me Xanax and Valium, and, you know, they gave me everything I need. Well, 160th Aviation in Fort Campbell, Kentucky was being formed. I was there in 1980. They took what they'd done is to form the unit. They took a lot of old special forces experienced in combat from Vietnam, and they placed them in the aviation company, taught them to fly because they didn't want them flying in the restrictive capacity that normal aviators are taught. For the Army and for the Air Force and Navy. So they put us in this special unit, trained us specially to not be confined by existing safety regulations. We flew primarily with night vision goggles, day goggles and night goggles. We'd practice every time we flew as often as we could. We would be flying with night vision goggles, thus the name the Night Stalkers. When you're in a helicopter, you're low and you're slow. And the only thing you have is the element of surprise because you're vulnerable to small arms fire. You're vulnerable to people throwing rocks at you. We would fly so low. So, we worked and trained and worked and trained, flying in around the United States. We'd practice, flying Delta Force operatives. We practiced flying, special ops guys. All over the United States, we do practices into cities, into major cities, wearing filters going in. We'd attack casinos. We'd drop them to the top of the casinos. They'd rappel down into the top of the casino, just for practice for the anti-terror training. And
you were the guys, Gene, that was buzzing my house probably on many times, or at least that squad, right?
If you were in Denver, I was. Sure, we around the United States in all environments. We did a lot in Colorado because it was such a high altitude, and the lighter the air with these helicopters, the more difficult things were. So we trained for that. Finally, we decided, look, this is, you know, we can train, but the one thing we can't do is get a practical application of this. So the opportunity came off of a little island in the Caribbean, when some Cuban military decided to go into the island and start building a small Cuban base there. The name of the island was Grenada. Grenada was a perfect platform for us, a perfect entity for us to test our new arms platforms, our new armament, our flight techniques, and everything we had as a 160th. So Ollie North, who was in the National Reconnaissance Office, got authorization, General Schwarzkopf was to run the operation, and we took off on ships, went down to the small island Grenada, and for 2 days we raided that small island. We did, however, save some, not that they needed save, we saved some medical students who were there. That was the Grenada invasion, in case anyone ever wondered why we really went there. We went there to test those platforms. It was basically training, what we call real fire training. After Grenada, I was sent to Fort Stewart, Georgia. In the early 80s, the United States government, the CIA, decided to start a campaign of war against a regime in Nicaragua called the Sandinistas. The Sandinistas had won by popular vote, came in, but because they were a group that may start nationalizing properties and taking properties away from the banana growers, American banana growers, and the American oil industry, they decided it would not be in America's best interest and national security's best interest for that to happen to our corporations. So they started training a group of the Somozans, which were a pretty rowdy and pretty cruel bunch of military forces who had been outed by the Sandinistas. They would routinely, they had death squads, they would go in, they would rape and pillage in the villages of Nicaragua. That's what got them voted out, what was the whole Somozan regime. But these ended up being the people that the CIA recruited to build this new army to go up against the Sandinistas called the Contras. They promised them if they would come into the Contra camps, they would pay them daily. They could bring their families in. They would have food. They would have protection. They would have money. They would have all the arms they would need, and they would have all the training. And they did that. They did that for several years until Congress found out about it. We were mining some harbors in Bluefields, Nicaragua, using NOAA ships and Navy SEALs. And one of the SEALs got his hand blown off, and we had to take him out, extract him, and fly him to some hospital ships. When they found out about that, they enacted the Boland Act, which only allowed U.S. assistance in the form of humanitarian assistance to the Nicaraguans. That included food and medical. So they decided this is what we're going to do. They took two special ops crews, sent them to Fort Stewart, Georgia. They sent us to Fort Stewart because Fort Stewart was coming up on the list of aviation companies that were going through rotation and going over to Honduras for a year. So we got into Fort Stewart as medevac pilots. We were sent in, I believe, January. We were sent January of 84. We were sent to Honduras. I was under the control of three entities. I flew for the United States Army, medevac, under control of the hospital commander in the local aviation unit. I flew for the Enterprise, and I flew for the third entity that we flew for. It was called Pegasus Group. And we could be called on missions by any one of those three groups. We had a man, major in Honduras, from military intelligence, that his name was Major Rodriguez. People may have heard of him. His real name is Felix Rodriguez. He was working for the CIA and one of their best fighters for many years, including against the Cubans. In Honduras, the missions called by North, by the National Reconnaissance Office, would often take us into flying medevac helicopters. We would be flying arms and arms, munitions, and intelligence personnel into the Contra camps, into the Nicaraguan, what we call the buffer zone, dropping those off. And invariably, they would fill us up with coolers, at least 10 coolers. These are these big, big coolers, like 110-quart coolers, if you've all ever seen them. Big white coolers, blue coolers, whatever. And those coolers, and we never really looked at them because they were coming out. We were just dropping them off to aircraft in San Pedro Sula and in San Lorenzo. one on San Pedro on the Caribbean side with military aircraft bound for Panama. San Lorenzo on the Pacific side was all civilian aircraft. Barry Seal was one of the pilots that would invariably pick those up. One day we had a hard landing, and one of the coolers fell out the open door and busted open, and there we saw all these bricks of cocaine. So we knew then what we were doing. I called North, and I said, "Do you know what's in these coolers?" He said, "Yeah, I know what's in those coolers." I said, "Well, what the hell are we doing here?" He said, "Well, don't worry about it, Tatum. It's all evidence for the world courts. It's the fruits of war that we got from the Sandinistas, from the Nicaraguans." I said, "There's no way that every week we fly in there and get new coolers from the Sandinistas." He said, "I told you not to worry about it." I said, "All right." And from that day forward, every flight plan that I flew on, we marked on that flight plan exactly what we had on board. We counted the coolers. We named the names of the people. We recorded everything that was said in the back of the aircraft and kept those. Now, I had published in what's called the Tatum Chronicles. That's on my website, chiptatum.com, chiptatum.com. Go to downloads. You can download copies of those official United States Army flight plans. And on the front and on the back, signed by all the crew members, are pretty amazing statements from the time. I had gone back and gotten those a couple years later from the Honduran military running the base where we were flying out of. They maintained copies of our flight plans. Where am I? In 1986, it was time for me to leave. They caught on to us making these illegal flights, and so the Army said, "You guys are out of there. You can't keep making these illegal flights." So the people I worked for pulled me out of the military, put me in civilian service, running what we call proprietary companies. They gave me a proprietary construction company up in New York, upstate New York, gave us a $250,000 line of credit. We never built anything, by the way. Gave us a $250,000 line of credit, and our job was to go fly. We had missions going around the world, and we based out of Syracuse, New York. We'd fly fixed-wing aircraft. We'd fly rotary-wing aircraft. Many times we'd be moving people under radar across the Canadian border back and forth, people and money. On some occasions we'd fly, we moved money for a general in Indonesia. He had $26 million he needed to get out. I guess that was his blood money. We ended up flying that into Costa Rica and hiding it in some Costa Rican banks for him. We've flown missions for the Prince of Brunei. We've flown a lot of missions for the Israelis, One in particular, there was an Israeli officer went by the AKA Pat Weber, whose name was really Amiram Nir. And he was on a flight in Mexico, and they decided that he was a little getting a little too loose on things and didn't feel that he was it was safe for them to allow him. He had just been petitioned to come, summoned to come to the United States to testify in some Iran-Contra hearings against General Secord, Sinlab, and North, and President Reagan, Vice President Bush, against Poindexter, against all of them. And they decided that he couldn't do that. So we were given the mission, not knowing who it was or what it was all about, to take this aircraft down. And in our MD-500, we based out of Tegucigalpa, Honduras, we flew down and we took his aircraft down, and he was killed. That takes me through about about 1990, and working directly for the operational subgroups. We would, as I said, routinely fly to foreign countries. On one occasion, I can give you a little bit of information. We flew to France. There was a French politician that they needed to turn him on some kind of a vote. We flew a nerd team in. they hacked into the politician's bank account, stole all the money out of it. An operative was sent in and told him that if he didn't do what they needed him to do, he'd never see that money again. I guess they did it because we flew back in about 3 weeks later and fixed the accounts for him. In 1992, in a meeting in, let me backtrack. While I was at Fort Campbell, I know Stu wants me to talk about this, and I'm going to let him talk about what he knows about it. In 1982, I was at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. We would routinely, those coolers I was talking about, we weren't the only medevac pilots doing that. We had a medevac out of Fort Campbell that got the call too, and those were special ops pilots, and they would bring coolers back. They would put on C-130s and bring them back. On one particular occasion, flying cross country, we were given a cooler and told to drop it off at the Little Rock Air Force Base. We flew that little small cooler to Little Rock Air Force Base. It said medical supplies. I didn't believe it, so I opened it. It had about 10 kilos of cocaine and a whole bunch of money stacks sitting in it. We flew it into Little Rock Air Force Base. We were met by a limo owned by Jackson Stevens. Mr. Stevens got out of the limo, identified himself, introduced us to the then governor of the state, William Clinton. Stu, you got something there?
Yeah, well, how about Bill Clinton's brother? What did he say? The DEA's got him on tape saying?
One particular friend of mine from the DEA told me that in one particular, Jackson, let me qualify this. Jackson Stevens was an international banker. He also had huge parties in his home, in his mansion there in Little Rock. I mean, he's known for the parties. His chauffeur was named Roger Clinton. Now, Roger was Bill Clinton's brother. It was Roger's job to go out and make sure that all the party favors were there. And so he'd go out and his job was to go out, get the dope, get the weed, get the powder, get everything. He was talking to one of his suppliers and, he told the supplier, listen, I know I ordered this much, but, I'm going to need a little more because my brother's coming to the party and he's got a nose like a vacuum cleaner. Speaking of, our esteemed President Clinton, but then governor.
I throw a few things in there, Benny, that over the years I've also heard and investigated and got from a lot of shadow types like Gene. I've only known about 10 or 12 of them. But I've known tons of
them. Gene, you might want to stop typing, or if you are going to type, press mute, because we can hear that. Okay, sorry. Stu, continue. Anyway,
yeah, Jackson Stevens was all directly hooked up with Leonard Melman and Larry Mizell and Hillary Clinton. And that all encompassed what was called BCCI, Bank of Credit and Commerce International, which the La Rock law firm came and saw me and others when they put Charles Keating in jail. That's what actually put him in jail, was a private RICO suit because the government refused to do their job. They were covering it all up. And it encompassed the Saudi royal family, members of the Bush family. It encompassed Larry Mizell and MDC, which settled in the case fraudulently, claiming they were in bankruptcy when he filed a fraudulent frauds upon the court filing. It was on a land track subsidiary company to try to get by with saying to keep from paying hundreds of millions that they stole in billions. But that was what put Charles Keating in jail. But what was interesting, just about a year before that, the Securities and Exchange Commission came after Jackson Stevens. And when he came out after Jackson Stevens, guess who the attorney of record was? Hillary Witch Clinton. So it's just an endless, interesting tidbit.
Oh, you just can't make this stuff up, Stu.
I have the documents to prove it.
That's actually one of my favorite phrases. You know, like whenever Alex Jones says it, I just crack up laughing. I have the documents. And he's damaged me for life. I can't, like, nobody can say to me, I have the documents, without me going a little bit, you know? I don't know what it is about people having documents. It's just funny to me.
Let me see if I can find the one on the computer and drop it into you in the chat room between us here, right? Gene continues his story. Now, Gene, you were heavily involved in Colorado at one time, too, in some loan stuff, weren't you? Chip, you still there?
You might be on mute.
Yes, when I was stationed in Italy and doing work in the mid-70s in Yugoslavia, following that tour, I was sent to the high plains of Colorado to a place called Operation OLAB, a top secret AT&T site that wasn't really an AT&T site on the high plains of Colorado, out in the middle of nowhere. The closest town had about 15,000 people in it. And we were based out of Colorado Springs and out of NORAD, Cheyenne Mountain was our home base. So every week, we would have to take a trip for administrative purposes, drive into Colorado Springs, or many times because Buckley Field had a lot of communications entities, and that's what we were. We would have to go drop off tapes and that we had recorded from the communications from our sending communications into space, and what we'd receive back, we'd take those tapes to Buckley and drop those off. But every time we went to Denver, we would be charged with stopping at a little savings and loan, picking up several boxes of documents and dropping those off at an attorney's office in Denver by the name of Brownstein in Denver. One time I decided just to see what the heck was in these documents and in these boxes. And it was nothing, just houses, just, you know, loan documents and titles to lands and things like that. So I didn't think anything of it until years later when I met Stu, and Stu said, you know, you ever find out what they were doing with those 70,000 homes that were stolen from HUD? And I got to thinking about it. I said, oh my God, I know where they went. And that's exactly where they went. They were going into this guy named Brownstein, and Stu can tell you who Brownstein is.
Brownstein was my former father-in-law's attorney, and he was Daddy Bush's attorney, who was one of the six CIA counsel when George Herbert Walker Bush was CIA director in the 1970s. And he was on the board of directors of Silverado Savings and MDC Holdings, that was the parent company for Silverado, where Neil Bush was. It was the CIA bank. And I do have those documents. I'm going to drop to you right here. Why we let Gene continue. He's come across a lot of things, but I'm going to drop the document on this BCCI showing Hillary Clinton. And that way you'll have one for yourself, Benny. How's that sound?
Well, you know, I'm not much of a document reader. I leave that to the serious researchers. I'm just a douchebag interviewer with a microphone, bro.
I worked with Jonathan Beatty of Time Magazine that broke out about the Denver airport, because I couldn't get the Denver Post or the Rocky Mountain News to break the story about their illegal political campaign money laundering.
Yeah.
I'd put the Denver Post and the Rocky Mountain News before it was bought out by the crowd that owned the Houston Post, Dean Singleton that owns Associated Press. That's all controlled by Mizell in Denver. And before that, they had probably done about 50 stories for me, the two different newspapers. And I was working the press back then when I was behind the scenes in that 89 to 91 time frame. And, of course, then I got the infamous trip like Chip does, and charged with terroristic death threats that never occurred. And then later the charges were dismissed after being held for 10 and a half months. And I came across people that were in the lower level than what Chip was. It was probably a lot of the people he was extracting out of camps down there in Nicaragua, and different stuff were all in there, where Daddy had all these Iran-Contra boys locked up. There were 1,500 of them locked up in Springfield, Missouri, where they were all being mentally evaluated, trying to say they were nuts, making up this stuff. They tried to do it to me. It didn't work. Shrink said there wasn't anything wrong with me. And they even said they couldn't understand why I'd even been sent there, that there was no evidence to send me there, that it was a newspaper article that was written in Westward newspaper where they had tried to slander me after I'd been arrested. And the whole bit, and that's because I caused those scandals. But I worked with Beatty, and Beatty spun out of there while I'm hiding from the FBI between 91 and 92. They wanted to kill me, Daddy Bush, and got arrested in September of 92. But during that period of time, I was working with Jonathan Beatty. Well, he got his contract, $1 million book deal with Time Magazine, you do the book called The Outlaw Bank, BCCI, Bank of Credit and Commerce International. That's where a lot of the savings and loan money got laundered through, folks. That's where a lot of your money was stolen and laundered through. Charles Keating and all that European investment group, which included the Saudis, the UAE, you name it, they were all pumping the money through there, right out of America. And it was going through a Swiss Bank Corp in Switzerland and Bank of Credit, Commerce International, et cetera. But I'm going to drop you the document on Hillary, where you can see this. And Gene, you might want to load down on too. But anyway, why don't you continue on this?
Because might I interject here? While we were talking, I recall we tried to do this interview in video, and there was some kind of technical issue. While we were talking, I actually looked up on Skype, and it turns out that we might have the older versions of Skype. So I was thinking we should take a quick 5-minute break, upgrade our Skypes, and then come back for the second and third hours in video. How's that sound?
Well, that sounds okay with me. I'm upgraded already as of a few days ago, but... Why don't we try it? Unless they got a new version since then.
Oh, well, it's. I think it might just be me, so. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we'll see you after the break. And, of course, the videos, bear in mind, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show are uploaded to the YouTube channel, Mr. News, Guerrilla Media. Other than that, you know, the audio is just fine, isn't it? You know, it gives you a little bit of something to the imagination. Plus, I'm not that pretty, and I'm just getting worse. We'll be right back after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Don't you go anywhere, folks. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number 2 of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, now being done via webcam for the YouTube listeners. And what I'd like to do is basically continue where we left off. I think, what was the last thing you were talking about? Hillary Clinton or some kind of legal jargon or whatnot, was it?
Well, it was regarding BCCI, and I tried to send the documents there, and what I have to do is stick them up in the next couple of days, but I just gave you the document, the Securities Exchange Commission document, Gene Chip Tatum loaded down, part of it. It shows her signature on there, and she was the BCCI attorney representing them initially. So, you know, she's been deeply in bed with them.
In some cases, literally.
Well, yeah. I
mean, Not with guys. Not with guys.
Gene's correct. There are too many females. She's a lesbian. Definitely a blazing lesbian. And, you know, I think if you were to touch on that subject, it was one of the tabloids out of the American media down there out of Florida that got anthrax had done it. When she was a first lady, had done a expose on her and showed, I think it was 16 or 18 of her lesbian lovers that were going in and outside the White House with comments about Secret Service agents who was saying that she would go into their house and they would be there, and then later they'd see the bedroom light on and they'd look in the living room window and they were going up the stairs of the bedroom, and later the lights were dimmed in the bedrooms, and you know, this was just a routine with her a couple times a week. She had to go have her lesbian hot sex.
So routine, you know, no pun intended.
Well, whatever. But, you know, she was involved with setting up trusts in the Rose Law Firm. And she was involved with the murder of Vince Foster. I know that. Matter of fact, I have a document, and this is a fact, where Larry Mizell, KeyBank, in a lawsuit, he had to turn over, or he did turn over his diary for the day, on the particular day that Vince Foster was murdered, that he had met with him an hour before the murder. Okay? This is bank bailout scamster. And the only reason he did that is because the attorneys were trying to prove that he was in communication with Key Bank on that particular day regarding certain frauds that were conducted on that day. And he said, oh, no, I'm in Washington. I was meeting several people. Well, in those notes was Vince Foster, 1 hour before he was murdered. So ask yourself the question. I've also known, Gene Chip Tatum knows, Bill McCoy. He's no longer living and breathing because of his exposure of Oklahoma City, but he was a very heavyweight.
Is that where the term the real McCoy comes from?
Well, it was.
He was a heavyweight. Daddy Bush was scared to death of him. So was everybody. But Bill had tons of stuff. But one of the things Bill found out was there was a yellow pickup truck that went to the White House the day that or that evening that they later found Foster's death or body in the Mercy Park or wherever it was. No mud on his feet, and it was muddy and rainy that night, whatever. There was a Hensel Phelps Construction Company truck that was based out of Greeley, Colorado, is where their home base is. But the Hensel Phelps yellow pickup truck, I remember the license number. I don't have Alzheimer's quite yet, but the license number was RCG702, Little Rock, Arkansas. Went and picked up a rug, and it took three people to carry the rug out. So it was a pretty good-sized rug with a body laying in the middle of the rug, is my understanding. So you could take that for what it's worth.
Now, also, Stu, if you can turn your speakers down a little, there's a bit of feedback.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Okay. No problem. So, when we come down to this, understanding that there are assassin groups and things of that nature, one thing that a lot of conspiracy theorists tell me is that people like myself and David Icke and Alex Jones, anybody who's exposing any kind of government conspiracy automatically gets whacked, and so therefore we're all part of the Illuminati. What do you reckon? You know, is the Illuminati all powerful? Could they just kill anybody, or is there another element involved here? Because I've been talking with a number of people who've had attempts on their life, but it's almost like divine intervention. Like they'll have voices in their heads that tell them, "Don't go there, don't do this," or something like that. And then they find out later on that had they gone there, done that, they would have been killed. So I'm thinking that there's. There's not only this real physical kind of element to the New World Order agenda and suppressing freedom and so on and so forth, but there's also a spiritual element as well. What do you think?
Well, I can tell you, it's out of 17 assassination missions, all 17 were successful on our parts.
Mm.
And sometimes we had to go back a second time, but we got it done.
Okay. Okay.
Look, if we want you, if they wanted you, there is no intervention. I'm going to tell you that now. That if they want it,
yeah,
we can do it.
Mm.
Doesn't matter who it is, okay, presidents, premiers.
I do believe in angels of protection. That's my Christian belief. And Psalms 92, he says, if you ask for them, you get them. I remember one time they were trying to get me in Colorado, Gene. And I'm driving on I-25 out of downtown Denver. And I'm going up to where the I-70 ramp is. And I'm in the, you know, the lane to continue north on I-25. And I'm in this little Pontiac Grand Am in 94 I'd bought new. And all of a sudden, I get nearly rammed in the left side. And I'm forced to cut in front of someone and go off on the exit ramp, which would have taken me in, up around and over and gone west on I-70. Well, all of a sudden, this guy on the right side that was trying to squeeze me, he starts coming over into my lane. I'm moving over a little bit, and he's intentionally trying to push me off the road. And then all of a sudden, I felt him clip me. Boom! I went flying. I mean, I went flying in midair, and I screamed, "Help Jesus!" This is honest God's truth. I came down in the middle of rush hour traffic, landed. I went at least 60, 80 yards up in the air, came down on I-25, landed in the middle of the freeway. And as I landed, here's a freeway. As I landed, I hit like this and started to go this way off the middle. And, of course, I pulled it back. And after I'd screamed, "Help Jesus," I looked in my rearview mirrors. I'm stomping on my gas. Get out of the way. I think I'm going to get crushed. The whole friggin' freeway was stopped behind me. Now, what was happening there? Maybe an angel standing out there said, "Wait a minute."
No, Stu, the divine intervention for you was they didn't send me.
Okay.
So are you saying that there are comparable levels of teams? Like certain teams have 100% success rate, and it's just like, you know, let's try and kill this guy. Yeah, but I don't really feel like making sure that he's dead. Let's just send like the 50-50 guys, you know.
No, we carry what's called the fifth man, and the fifth man always understand his job is to make sure it's done.
Okay.
There was one of the last times they tried to get me. If you want to take a look at this one real quick, here I'll go to share screen. I think it's called. But if you take a look here, I guess is my screen up where it's showing on my website.
No, not at all. Not at all. I think maybe if you turn your webcam off and then do screen share.
Is that the way you have to do it?
Maybe. Okay. I don't know. I've never done this before.
I don't know how to work this. I thought it. I thought you start. Started.
Okay. Are you talking about the pictures of your car mangled and all of that kind of thing?
Right in front of my website, right in the middle, that's where they hit me in the left rear and tried to take me out. They hired FBI was using there were about 14, 15 Somalians over a period of time. We know it's the FBI that did it. And they came up alongside of me. I'm in the middle lane, and all of a sudden I see a separation, and this car's dragging the wall, and all of a sudden, before I get out of the way, he shoots it right in my left. There goes my van. All I could see was a concrete barrier coming up through the windshield three times, broke my neck in six places. So that wasn't a pleasant experience. And two more car crashes, and one of them was a drug hauler. Do you ever remember the name? Stevens Truck Driving School. You remember that, Gene? From Arkansas, hauling the drugs out of Mena? Well, an IRS agent tried to bust him some 20 some odd years prior after I turned in Silverado. She calls me up and she says, "Mr. Webb, you know, I'm an agent with the IRS. You turned in your ex-in-law and all the Silverado stuff. Can I meet with you?" I said, "Sure." So she came out the house, met with me, and she says, "What do you know about this? So many millions of dollars in this Jay's truck driving school from here in Kansas City." And I said, "I know nothing about it." And so then I started digging with some different ones and started asking, because I'd gotten a little bit of a wind that there was some stuff coming out of Arkansas. And I knew the Arkansas State Patrolman down there that later they anthraxed. And I started working with him quite often. But Jay's truck driving school had laundered. They were picking up drugs that was part of the MENA operation in Joplin, Missouri, and then would bring it into Kansas City, into Omaha, and into St. Joe, Missouri. And this was Jay Stevens was his name. And so, anyway, she calls me up about 3 weeks later and said she had been fired from the IRS. I said, "What? Oh, yeah, over this is so hot, and all this other, over some kind of special accounts at Silverado, and over the Jay's thing." So I helped her get it on TV5 here in Kansas City, KCTV5. It was Stan Kramer and Stan Carmack both helped us produce that. And that was the summer that they actually put the heat on me and came after me with a warrant shortly after that. I'd come across Gunther Rusbacher during that period of time. And, Gene, you knew Gunther. You had met with him and you knew him. That was the first CIA. And he was in prison. His wife was... His former wife, I'll tell you a quick story, is Rumor Mill News. And she had a husband that was a colonel, reportedly. He ends up dead. Gunther had been dating her, and she was trying to seduce him. And then she convinces him, gets him drunk, convinces him to marry her one night. and I guess he did it in Las Vegas or something like that. Well, 2 weeks later, guess what? He's in a prison cell, or a month later, he's in a prison cell set up where she had set him up. Her husband, before she married him, was dead 2 days before mysterious death. Then he gets out of jail. He's with her for less than 2 weeks, and he runs off to Austria, because he didn't want anything to do with her. Well, I've heard a lot of bad things about Rumor Mill News and Ray Allen Rusbucker since we're outing the APEC-controlled stooges. You could ask a lot of questions. Why does she have Knights Templars on her website? Why does she not allow true information to be posted up there? Why is it always Spin Doctor? Because I outed, I'm going through this outing period where we're outing the stooges. Just like APEC-controlled Alex Jones stooge, it's time to start saying again who they really are. But the point that I was making is that, heck, I don't know. I was someplace with it.
That's commonly known as a fail. Here's the other element as well. Chip, you're telling me that they want Stu alive, they want you alive, and they want me alive, otherwise we'd be dead? Like, there's... Why not tie up the loose end? Why let you turn whistleblower? Why let you come out and talk about these things?
I can talk about me. I can't talk about why you guys are still around, but I can talk about me. When I was charged with treason, I had the opportunity to present my case to a federal judge, and I laid the evidence out, some of the evidence out in front of him. And that evidence that I laid out in front of him, stating that, you know, they're really just trying to get me, get a felony on me so that if I do am called to testify against them, I won't be credible because I'm a felon at that point. That's their ploy on that. They knew they couldn't take me out because of everything I had planted all around the world. They certainly didn't want that to happen. But the things I'm allowed to talk about and can talk about to you guys today are the things that were involved in that court case in what's called a SEPA briefing. It's called Classified Information Procedures Act. They close the doors. We go in behind closed doors. You have the judge, you have the U.S. attorney, you have my attorneys, and you have a stenographer, and that's it. And all of those have to have security clearances. They make the decision in that SEPA briefing whether the information that I intend to use in my defense is classified or not. The judge said, well, Judge looked at everything we had, who I worked for, everything else, and he said, well, this is what I think, gentlemen. I think it's not classified. I'm going to call it not classified, because if I call this classified, I have to get the jurors, all security clearances for all the jurors. We're talking about a year down the road for this whole court case to take place. We have to get all the attorneys and everyone who's going to be in there, the bailiffs, the marshals all have to have top secret clearances. And he said, and that's very time consuming, and we may end up having to go through new jury selections. Some of them may not pass it. So he said it could be 1, 2, 3 years down the road. So I'm going to say that this is not classified, but I'm also going to say that you cannot use it in your defense. And that's a matter of fact in the record, federal court records, and I'll have those up on the site. They're already on the internet somewhere, I believe, in several places.
Mm. So basically, the reason why they aren't going to kill you is because it'll actually wind up worse for them, because all your information will come out, right?
Exactly.
So you've got them by the short and curlies to a degree.
And I can't go into certain areas, because if I go into areas that weren't in that SEPA briefing, there's 25-year statute of limitations minimum on that. Classified period. So, you know, that carries me that was in 1992 when I left. So I've got till 1917.
And I've done the same.
I've got 25 years to wait to talk about some of the stuff. So the stuff that was in that briefing, I can talk about, and I'm talking about. Items, there's so much more. Oh, there's so much more. Vinny, but I can't talk about it. If I do, I can face 25 years in prison.
And Vinny, I'm like, I've learned from Gene and learned from others in his level. There's several of them that I know on his level, probably a dozen. that provide me, a lot of them still provide me with information. And I mean, there's people that Gene was probably in a level 4, 3, 4, because he worked for Ollie North and George Herbert Walker Bush both. Al Martin, we both know him. Knew Bill McCoy, you know, Gene or Terry Reed, which doesn't live far from me. He doesn't live far. Larry Nichols. I mean, there's been several whistleblowers out here over the years that have come out. But, you know, there's not many that were in the level that Gene Chip Tatum and Gunther Rossbacher has been public, and I think a few others. There's not many that were in that level that have ever come out and spoken. I think Gene's been the most outspoken one, him and Al Martin. And Al Martin kind of got camera shy, should we say, or radio shy for a while. He has a book, The Conspirators, out, AlMartinRaw.com. So what you're hearing, you know, has been said. A lot of the things were said by Gene here back in 95 to 97. I mean, I must have done 100 radio programs with him to introduce him into patriots such as yourself, to say, okay, Vinny, you got a real player here. Take it from here. Next time you put him on, you don't need me. I'm just introducing him into the patriot world right now and those concerned Americans, and let you hit him with the questions later on so you get familiar with him. Well, God, Gene, how many shows did you do? 500 back then? I think in a year and a half, a year at a time.
Hundreds. So, and, you know, Vinny, one thing I want to say is, the reason I came back, I'm coming back now, is a friend has convinced me to do this. I didn't intend on coming back out when I came back to the United States. But she said, you know, let me tell you something, Chip. What you said back then has more relevance now, because the things you said were going to happen have actually happened. And now it's not a conspiracy, it's a fact.
Well, what do you mean? Did you make a whole bunch of predictions that came true, thing?
A whole bunch, a whole list of them.
Regale me.
Okay. Federal prisons being built on military installations. Before they started putting the prisons on military installations, I explained to them. We sat in meetings, in planning meetings in Jupiter Island with Mr. Bush, Cheney, all of my bosses. North carried on. He didn't, when he left military service, he still carried through with the OSGs. And they had planning meetings. We would sit there in these meetings and they would plan out, the operations that were coming up on a quarterly basis. We'd have planning meetings. We would sit and we would hear the FEMA plans. A lot of people didn't know of Rex 84 when it was written. I was telling them about Rex 84, and then finally in the 90s it came public. The use of FEMA and the executive orders that can take away all power of Congress. I was trying to explain that to people. They just couldn't believe that would ever happen in the United States, that Congress could be taken out of the quotient. But it's happened. I talked to him about the kill lists that the president have, how we have lists. I showed him a copy of the order, an executive order that shows authorization to kill someone and why. They couldn't believe that the United States would assassinate people.
There were a lot of, a lot of older patriots, should we say, at that time, that was the movement with Ross Perot and the Third Independent Party, and that was the movement with what was called the militias and a lot of the other patriots. I mean, they weren't afraid to come out. They'd come out of their houses, go to a meeting. About 1,000 people attend a meeting. I spoke at many of those meetings. They weren't chicken. Now we got all these people that want to sit around a frigate computer and watch a video and post their favorite disinformation stories that they see off of these depth sites, these Israeli disinformation sites, and these talk show hosts that want to lie to people that are stooges or post up on the rumor mill. That's all it is a mill of rumors and lies, because they take down any real thing that would ever be posted up there. And the Alex Jones, the boogeyman's going to come get you. The military's going to come get you. But he says in the past week, according to one source of mine who's monitoring him, a U.S. intelligence agency is monitoring him, because he's going to get arrested as a co-conspirator one of these days to treason and sedition with the Israelis and putting out disinformation about the Boston bombing and Newtown shooting and other things. And those that co-conspired as well, Glenn Beck and others, will probably be arrested because they've done it for a number of years. But, you know, his statement was in the past week, oh, I wish I had the money. I think I would move to Switzerland now. Well, you better get out of the country if you're going to go, because Abe Foxman just ran off to Israel, left his $500,000 a year job. There's a whole bunch of Israelis that are going to be arrested soon with AIPAC and ADL and all this treason that went on. And Stooge, I've asked for special permission. I probably won't be given it. I just want to be deputized for 3 days. I want to carry the badge and the duct tape handcuffs to go in and arrest these bastard stooges that have been out here in the alternative so-called media that's putting out all this disinformation. And I'd really like to get Alex Jones to put the handcuffs on him. But I will challenge Alex Jones, and I've done it on another program, that here's the deal. I will tie, and you decide, Alex Jones, which hand you want to tie behind my back. Anything goes, barehanded, anything goes, and I will meet you in the ring. And if you kick my ass out of the ring, I shut up permanently forever. If I kick your ass out of the ring, you shut up permanently forever. And the first thing I'm going to do to you is I'm going to rip your ears off and hand them to you before the fight starts. We're going to stop there, okay?
Okie dokie, Stu. Maybe a little over the top, but fair enough.
Okay, that's fair enough, isn't it? When you think so, hey, good guy versus the bad guy. Let's see who takes who on. Come on.
Yeah. Well, you know, you can have that. You can have that. Me personally, I'm just kind of like, I'm in a league of my own, you know. So if Alex Jones wants to come and attack me and so on and so forth, you know, so be it. I'll start coming after him and what have you. But you guys are breaking up really significantly there. Do you want to turn your speakers down a little bit there, Chip?
Did you have something to play there, Chip?
Okay. Well, anyway.
Put on my earphones.
Okay, that's probably a good idea.
Here's what,
actually,
here's what Gene sent me the other night. Said you ought to put this up. He said after years.
Hey, I just came up with a joke. Actually, you know how he said that Alex Jones working for AIPAC and how he used to be a smoker. I wonder what kind of cigarettes he smoked. Did he smoke AIPAC cigarettes?
No.
He might have. Here's the tape that Gene sent me the other night. He says, oh, man, you need to. Okay, let me see if I can play it here. Yeah. Oh, ho, ho.
Everybody was kung fu fighting. Those kids were fast as lightning. In fact, it was a little bit frightening.
So here's my challenge. I'm gonna get you, rip your ears off, bitch. Give me in a ring, punk.
You heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. Texas is going to be on fire tonight. It's going to start in the oil fields, I'm sure.
One hand. David Jones, tell me which one.
Okay. Maybe we're going off a little off topic here. Yeah. Well, maybe we're going a little off topic here. Let's move on. Or rather, let's move back. To assassinations, predictions, and these kind of things. Because here's another element that I actually want to get into. Because if this system exists, and it so exists, to kill the political enemies of the elite and so on and so forth, how do you resist such an enemy? Because I don't think it matters whether or not you know and you're aware of a team of ruthless criminal assassins that have 100% kill rate, because even if you know that, you're 100% freaking dead, aren't you?
Yes.
So, here's a question. What's the point in even talking about this then? If there's nothing we can do.
let me give you a prime example of this.
Yeah.
When we were in Nicaragua, in Honduras, we fought that war for years. I believe the Contras started in 1980, and they went through 1989. And finally, in 1989, the whole idea was to get Daniel Ortega, the then Sandinista president, to acquiesce and go and allow new elections. We fought the war. We had the Contras in there. They were pillaging the country with our support, and they really weren't getting where they needed to get. So what we did is we went to Ortega, and we told Ortega, this is what we're going to do, Mr. President of Nicaragua. You choose your family member, anyone you want, and we're going to kill that family member. And in 2 weeks, if you don't call for national elections, we're coming after you, and there's nothing you can do to stop us. He wouldn't choose the family member, of course, so we chose his cousin, and we told him, okay, this is who we're going to take out. And we're going to take him out in 2 weeks. You can put him wherever you want. He put him in El Alcatal on a military base in the middle of Russian Hind helicopters, a battalion of the highly trained guard that he had. And on that day in 2 weeks, his cousin was found dead, blown up in the hooch that he lived in by a missile. Nothing you can do. If someone really wants to do it, they're going to do it. And especially if it's a professional team.
Okay, then. Second question. How do you stay off that list? I think this might actually be some good advice, you know.
I honestly don't think that just talking about things, a lot of people go out there and they talk about things. That's not going to put you on the list. You're going to get on that list if you're someone who they really know knows. Someone who is actually has information that can be presented that can actually do harm to them. Talk's cheap. I mean, that's what it comes down to. Talk's pretty cheap. And unless you're an actual living threat to them, they're not going to waste their time because they have too many real threats out there to deal with. Look, it takes a lot of money. When we would be pulled on a mission, I'd go to Key Bank, we'd pull $250,000 out, and we'd go out on the mission. That's about what it costs for us to run one of the missions. Because we're paying each other, I had to pay my men in cash. We had our fuel, we had our arms, we had everything we had to do. And within the 2 days, that $250,000 line of credit at the bank was replenished to Key Bank. And we could go again. But it takes 3 or 4 weeks to do the planning and the pre-mission planning and everything to pull one of these off. You don't just look, he's leaving, jump in the car and chase him. That doesn't happen like that. Not like in the movies.
I was actually, as I said, I mentioned I interviewed Ole Damegaard last night, and he was explaining to me the template version, because he's analyzed a number of these assassinations. And everything that you've described about the timing of it, how many people in the team, and the selection of targets and everything like that, he told me last night. So you've kind of corroborated his story. And
something out real quick too is the Key Bank was owned by Larry Mizell and Leonard Millman, the APEC boys right out of Denver, Colorado. And matter of fact, it was even brought up, I think, in 1995 by Henry Gonzalez before his retirement, and he was House Banking Chairman, because I used to talk to him probably a dozen times between 91 directly with the congressman. He was a good congressman, and he was after him again on Key Bank for money laundering. It became the new Silverado Savings Bank. Now I can tell you right now where it is. It's called Orchard Bank in Inglewood, Colorado. Who controls that? Larry Mizell. That's where MDC headquarters is, right there on DTC Parkway. We're out there on North Street. So if the feds wanted to get to the drug money laundering, just go to Orchard Bank, folks.
Also, one of the easiest ways to get your drug money laundered is if you have a company registered on the New York Stock Exchange. because if you've got it registered on the New York Stock Exchange, you don't have to file a transaction receipt to explain where your money comes from if you make deposits of over $10,000. And apparently, Pepsi and Coke have been implemented in billions of dollars of drug money laundering.
Well, and the head of Coca-Cola in Nicaragua was one of our targets, as a matter of fact.
Tell him about it. Gene?
Adolfo Calero was the head commander of the Nicaraguans. And Calero wanted money. He wanted a piece of the action. And they weren't going to give it to him. He also wanted the presidency. He was the head of Coca-Cola. He was with them from early years, with the enterprise from early years. And he was so bold, he came out and he told Bush, if you don't give me what I want, you're history. The whole world will know what we were doing. The way they neutralized him was using the satanic type worship technique. They took a Russian transvestite out of New York, sent her down to a Caribbean island, gave Adolfo a free trip to a Caribbean island on vacation. We fed them both with a drug called Burundanga. Burundanga is a derivative, a type of scopolamine, but it's much, much stronger than the normal scopolamine. And when a person takes this drug...
I don't even know what scopolamine is.
They used it in the 50s to get women through childbirth, and they would forget all the pain that they were going through. They would do whatever they said. If they say push, 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 the women would push, push, push. Because on scopolamine, you have complete control of your target. You'll have to redose them every few hours, but you can keep them under your control for – we've kept them up under control for 2 weeks. Beyond that, we started running into problems. They started going blind and dying on us. So we knew that we could only keep them under control for 2 weeks. But we would – this is a powder, very, very fine powder. You know when you open up a stick of gum and you see that little white powder? That's about how much that little white powder it would take to dose a person, and he's in your complete control within a few minutes. The good thing about it, they'll do anything you tell them to do, and they'll have complete amnesia when their effects wear off.
Reminds me of the book How to Create a Total Mind Controlled Slave.
Works. It works. You know that they tested it in the Ultra program and other programs. It's pretty historical, but they didn't test this version of it. It comes from a plant up in the high mountains of Peru, one of the different flowers. It's a trumpet flower that comes out of there. It's called datura, and they use the seed pods of the datura, the red and orange datura, yellow and red and orange looking. Now we took Calero and we put him on an island. We drugged him. We drugged the transvestite. We introduced him to the transvestite in a bar. Sent them back to their room together, and had the video rolling, 24 frames going at it. And it shows him having sex with her, her having sex with him, and shows him going right down and taking that big thing of that transvestite. And then the satanic part of it is, when it was all said and done, they had him kill her. They had him cut her heart out and take a bite out of it. Now, if you know anything about the Catholic culture, you know that if that ever gets out, no matter what, drugged or not, you're finished. You're done. Mm. 2 weeks later, I know that this happened because I saw the video. I wasn't there. I just saw the video because I was the man that delivered the video to Adolfo Calero. I met him in his office in Coca-Cola, and he acquiesced to see me. He received the video. He received the letter from Bush, and he sat there in tears. I got to tell you, I've seen some pretty gory stuff in my life, but I've never seen anything like that.
And there was a little another little thing that occurred was that according to Pete Bruton's book, now I didn't find this, but apparently Al Martin had given it to him. And Gene knows Al. Matter of fact, Al was the one that turned me on to Gene initially to get noise level raised back in the 90s. And Al had given in Pete Bruton's book, The Mafia, CIA, and Bush, about the Coca-Cola chairman, how there was a land swap, and he had this huge block of land in the DuPont land, they call it, down there in Florida, and encompassed about 1/16th of the state of Florida. Well, that land ended up being swapped with Millman, Mike's in-law, that had the Belize property, because there were 16,000 acres in Belize that he owned that was in hot water with the DEA, that they knew there was all these drugs being hauled out of there. So they swapped land, and then Coca-Cola went down and they hung a sign, or someone did, Tree Sweet Orange Juice, Coca-Cola. And so they made it look like they had just purchased this land and got Leonard Millman out of the hot seat over that land. And then when you look at the DuPont land, you'll see Neil Bush and Gulfstream Realty all of a sudden all over every place. And that was L. Millman and N. Bush, as in Neil Bush, that was working for my ex-in-law at Silver Rock.
In the 70s, Belize is one of the prime areas we used to do our CIA and special ops arms shows. They'd come in from around the world, put arms out on the airport, shut down the airport, and sell them.
I've got this philosophy that the 70s is the one decade in history where any actions that you do during the 70s are excused because it was the 70s.
I can buy that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You see, you guys have both lived through the 70s. You know exactly. Everything you did in the 70s was perfectly justifiable. Hey, it was the 70s, man.
Hey, 70s were the rock and roll and disco days, right?
That's it.
Yeah. In fact, I kind of...
Young kids then, Gene.
Huh?
Huh?
I said Gene and I were young kids. I'm 59, and you're up in here. You're what, 61 or 2, I think? Right there.
62, yeah.
Yeah.
Those were the good old times. Those were the good old days. But
for us, we were cowboys. The people I worked back in those days were just the cowboys.
Yeah.
Could go anywhere, could do anything, and we didn't have everything being able to track us. None of this stuff, none of this electronic stuff that could track us back then. And all through the 80s, too. I mean, we were pretty free to do what we wanted to in the 80s, too. After the mid-80s, things started changing a little bit.
Well, what happened in the mid-80s? Was that the Iran-Contra scandal or something like that?
Yeah, that's... after that, a lot of the trust of the... All the entities of the government, all the friction started coming out. There was a lot of mistrust. There was a lot of oversight done for the CIA and intelligence. And then the real kicker was in the 90s, when Clinton came into office. What happened with Clinton is because Clinton had declared that he smoked marijuana, but he didn't inhale it. And under U.S. law, he cannot have a security clearance. So the CIA refused to give him a security clearance. At that time, he took the CIA out of all embassies and he replaced it with the FBI. Huh. And so that's where the CIA lost their intelligence gathering abilities, because they were physically overtaken by the FBI.
Wow.
Wasn't Bill Clinton the guy that was, while he was shoving cigars in Monica, he was saying that he wasn't getting that a blowjob wasn't a sex? Isn't that what I
recall? No. I never had sex with her. She had sex with me. All right? It's totally different.
Who smoked those cigars after he had hot sex with her?
That's kind of like waterboarding isn't torture, huh?
Yeah. Or U.S. elections are free, or there's such a thing as democracy in the United States. You know, it's just like, well, actually, no. Democracy means mob rule, and as far as I know, the mob is a criminal organization, and they rule the United States, right? Or at least a mob of some form or another, right? So technically, America is a democracy. If you look at it that way, then it's a place where they have a political stage for the criminals to get elected.
Well, you know, there used to be at least two parties in the United States. Now there's only one party line. Yeah. And that one party line is all these congressmen and senators standing in the line to get their money from the special interest groups, from the PACs. Yeah. That's the one party line. That's all that there is now.
Somebody said a number of years ago that all it takes to bribe every single congressman and senator in the United States is actually quite a small amount, only like $30+ million a year. And that's it.
Oh, not even. You don't even have to pay him. Not with the things that we did. Look at Gary Hart. We took him out pretty quick.
Well, in fact, that reminds me of the MK Ultra programs, again, in the 70s, so it's okay, where they would get congressmen and they would drug them up on LSD or something like that, take them into little apartments that they had all the cameras and everything set up, get them to have sex with these people and or kill them, as you know, some similar to the story you told them, not so that they could release that information, just so that they could continually, forever, blackmail them into doing and passing whatever laws that they want.
And that's exactly what they did with Calero. They never released the information, but he always did exactly what they wanted.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's pretty straightforward, isn't it? Why would you give up your own life in order to do the right thing if the very people that you're trying to do the right thing against have so much over you that they can destroy your entire life and get nobody to believe you so that you can't even accomplish anything, even if you wanted to, except destroy your own life?
Exactly.
Boom. They freaking got you.
Head on.
Remember, America, Israelis, bitch. Just go on my website, stuweb.com, look at the middle column, and look at what we have in Jerusalem since 1991. It was given to me by intelligence. I put it up. If you take a look at it, it is the NSA base in Jerusalem. And what they're doing is 24/7, their technology's off the charts. They are sitting here watching us. They're listening to us. They can mind control you now through your TV, through your computer, or your cell phone, or your ground line. They don't have to put a chip in you. They don't have to do some of the tricks they used to do that Gene had done in the past and others. They don't have to do that anymore. That look at the Naval Yard shooter. As soon as the war in Syria was killed by basically good guys inside intelligence in our government, stop that war. Prove that the Syrians did not attack its people with sarin gas and that it was the Al-Qaeda, which is Daddy Bush's privatized army, financed by Saudi Arabia, done by Israel and the Mossad over there in Syria. It stopped everything. Russia, Putin stepped in, saved Barack Obama's face. And then what's the next thing the Israelis want to do? And the APEC boys, Bibi and his APEC boys. They want to start a war with what? Iran? Okay, that was also stopped. All of a sudden, we have a peace pact. There's a movement by good guys to put a halt to all this. Now, that happened. Okay, and if you look at why is it that Israel put a base in 1991? It ties back with Inslaw software. It ties back with E-Systems and the Westar satellite system, the original ones that were spying on us. I've released this on many, many shows. And it ties back even with that stooge at Ted Gunderson and Michael Reconosciuto that he put in jail, who developed the Inslaw. And that was the prosecutor software that they figured out to put back trap doors. Now, I've written about all this in the past 3 weeks to try to explain it out, at the lead up to the NSA base that's over there. And I've put that out. I've also put out about Jack Abramoff, who I helped get indicted with Carol Lamb, one of the fired U.S. attorneys. And she has put, I put that out about his blackmail ring. Child sex whorehouses in Washington. You know, the typical thing. They get them in a cocktail party, and they got the voodoo drug. They slip into their drink, and the next thing you know, Daddy Bush is around the corner because he likes little kitties. He's a pedophile. He's around the corner with the camera, and he comes in and shows them how to get the party started. And that's basically what was going on with Jack Abramoff at three different hotels in Washington. Now, on the front of my website, the middle column, is a lot of those links of recent stories, where I'm beginning to release stuff and tie it together where people understand it. Now, why do we have the state of Israel hooked up live direct to all of our intelligence, know where all our submarines are, all of our nukes live? They have everything and beyond what the NSA has. Shouldn't that be stopped like that after that report was set on the president's desk? And that copy of that media report that I put on Veterans Today, shouldn't that be stopped immediately? Where's the Justice Department? Where's the NSA shutting off the switches? I asked that question. That needs to be addressed. These bitches in Israel control the Congress and Senate, And the way they've been able to do it is because of this, because of that base going back to Daddy Bush in 1991. This guy has committed more treason and more sedition against America than anybody has ever done that I'm aware of that lives today. Would you be in agreement with that, Chip?
I'd say more than America, against the world. That's where we work, was international basis.
Yeah. How would you describe this man? Would you describe him good or evil?
The most evil man I have ever met. There's no doubt. And I've been down in the trenches with all the bad guys. You know, I've been in Colombia with all the drug dealers. I personally know the Escobar family and all the people in that arena. I've been down and dirty in the trenches with them, in the gutters of them. I've met some pretty nasty people in my life, but no one equals him.
I wanted to ask you a question, Chip, and I hope you don't get offended by this line of questioning. It's just to find out your psychological state of mind. Psychopathy is the ability to not have empathy. I want to know, do you actually feel guilt for these people that you've killed over the years? You know, do you have trouble sleeping, that kind of thing?
No, they were pretty well scumbags. So, they were bad. You know, when you first get into government service, you're, as a young recruit, I was all gung ho for America, apple pie, you know, to do what we can to defend America. But as you move up through the hierarchy, you start seeing more and more of what's really going on. And I would see that. And in 1992, I just got right there, fed up, and I walked away when they asked us to neutralize Ross Perot, and that's what ensued on me receiving the charge of treason. However, I know I did my job well. I was one of the best at what I did, and they knew I did my job well, one of the best at what I did. My job, I feel good about myself because I did do my job well. Had I done a crummy job, yeah, I'd feel bad about it. Had they been innocent angels, I might feel bad about it, but you know, I'm a warrior. I've killed thousands of people in war, in Vietnam and Grenada. I mean, looking through my years in combat and years, and when I talk about assassinations, those are just direct assassinations, dropping bombs, flying high level, dropping bombs. You know, I can't tell you how many thousands of people have died from the buttons that we push.
Hmm. And do you remember what your first kill was, and how did it make you feel?
My first kill was a rabbit.
No, I mean, I'm talking about a human being. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yes, it was in Vietnam. It didn't make me feel too bad. You know, the son of a bitch was shooting at me.
So you just kind of like, he's shooting at me, I shoot back, he's dead, yeah. Thank goodness for that.
I was raised with guns as a young man. We'd go hunting with my father every weekend, always taught gun safety. I had no problems using a gun, but if someone's going to shoot at me, I'm going to make sure that I get them first. If someone's going to fight with me, I'm going to make sure I'm the first one to swing. If anyone even comes near threatening, they're going down. They're not going to know that it's going to happen, but it's going to happen. I don't wait for them. All I have to do is feel the threat. I feel the threat. It's done.
Yeah. And you've not engaged in like torture or ritual sacrifice or anything of that nature. There was no commandments like that. It's simply take out the targets by the necessary means, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, Benny, I understand where Chip comes from. I've never killed anybody. I've damaged a few people that attacked me in self-defense. The last one was a 300-pound gorilla. I messed him up. I think there were three fingers broken, about six ribs. His eyeball was ripped out of his head, and he's still standing there, and I took half his ear off just to teach him a lesson, go home. He was in the hospital for 2 weeks because he decided to jump me. I won't even get into the story. I thought it was some Mossad's dudes. But I was Marine Corps trained. I military trained like Chip has been. His has been a little bit different. But I'll put it this way. You know, if I had to kill somebody in self-defense, yeah. And if I were working probably, you know, I'd gone in and been involved with what he did, thinking he was doing the right thing. You know, when you're young and you're in the military, you're dumb, aren't you, Gene? You follow orders. You do what you
Young, dumb, and full of cum. That's what they say.
Yeah. And so you do what you're told to do. And, you know, you're trained to do that. And if it becomes necessary, you do it. But, you know, so many people that, like Gene, that I've come to know, I know a lot of people, most of them, the super spooks, I call them, have all been involved in these different assassination programs and different things. And they're all good people. But many of them, as they said, Stu, got out of hand in the 1980s. It just went out of control to where they're so compartmentalized that one guy's doing one thing over here, somebody else is doing something over here, and someone else, and they're all working operations, and they really don't know what the bigger picture is. But then after about a month, they figure out what the bigger picture is, and they're going, shit, I'm really in deep trouble now if they ever wanted to use it against me. Now, is that about truth?
Dead on, yep.
Now, I've had this philosophy for a while, and you're kind of contradicting it here somewhat. People ask me, you know, why don't any of the bad guys ever get assassinated? Like, you never see the George Bushes and the Henry Kissingers of this world get assassinated. You know, why is that? Why is it always the John Lennons and the so on and so forth? All the people are like, oh, be peaceful, love everybody. Bam, right in the head.
You're paying the taxes to pay the sources or the Secret Service to continually keep them guarded. Why did they like those positions in government? Maybe that could be part of it. Mm. Why is George Bush got a taste tester, his chef? Sorry, you got to eat the food first, pal. Even his booze, he makes him open it up and start drinking some, right, Chip?
Well, is it because they're totally paranoid?
These days, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you would be, and you should be. And but the thing is, those bad people never get assassinated. And my thought was, it's because only a good person would want to see them get assassinated, and good people don't assassinate people.
That's probably about right too.
Well, I kind of classify myself as a good person, but I hear Leonard Millman's ghost is walking around on the Isle of Cuba, and I want to go down there with a .50 caliber and make sure it's dead. Here in the United States.
No, but see, again, we can always talk about wanting to go and do this, but we never do.
Hey, if someone would donate me the boat and donate me the .50 caliber with the scope, I'll sit right on the boat, pick it off. I'm getting a little bit older. I have to put reading glasses on to see fine print. They got this new scope. You just aim it in, and I can get right on your eyeball, Benny. And kaboom, he pulls the trigger itself. $1,000 right off the internet.
Well, there you go.
Anybody want me to go shoot a ghost, I'll be happy to.
Okay.
I don't know what law I'd be violating. I saw a dead man.
Now, do you have a PayPal account where people could donate your assassination money?
My website. I need my .50 caliber, my scope, and my boat ticket.
You know, Stu, years ago there was a paper written called Assassination Politics by a man named Bell. That was a very interesting concept. Maybe that's what you need to do. You start putting names out there, and then people bid on what they're willing to pay to see that person go. And the accounts get higher and higher and higher until they're high enough that someone picks up that contract and goes after it.
Yeah. The corporates wouldn't do that though, because they prefer no bid contracts. Okay, guys, we'll be right back after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Ladies and gentlemen, bear in mind this is a listener supported broadcast only. So if you want to donate some assassination money to me, go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. There is a Kiwi Bank account there for your assassin money, and also a PayPal there. And please, there are lots of bad people that need to be executed. So start up a regular recurring donation, you know, like on a monthly basis or something like that. We'll start up a list. We'll take them out. You know, it'll be fantastic at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question. And Eastwood isn't go ahead. Make my news. We'll be right back, folks.
I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling this as I fall off my chair, and I'm wondering how I get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right, here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you, and I'm wondering what it is I should do. It's so hard to keep the smile from my face, losing control, yeah.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number 3 of the most thrilling 3 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the listener-supported broadcast where we need your money in order to keep this show on the road so we can interview very important people who have lots of very interesting things to say from all over the world and across all spectrums of discourse. If you support that kind of a broadcast, this is the one to listen to, this is the one to sign up to, and give us a monthly contribution. We don't charge anybody to listen to the broadcast. I put it out all there for free, and I just hope that through my generosity of giving up all of my time pretty much every single day of the week, I think I've maybe 10 4 a.m. finishes in the last 2 weeks, up late editing, that kind of thing. I'm really busting my hump here, ladies and gentlemen. I can assure you, it's not worth it. So if you want to support me, please do. Go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, either through the PayPal or the Kiwi Bank there, and I really appreciate those who choose to sign up for regular donations as well. Even a dollar a month helps if there's enough people doing it. Okay, so back to my very special guest. We were talking about Elvis over the break, weren't we? Something along those lines. Stu, what do you know about Elvis, bro?
Well, it's kind of a strange twist of story, but I get a call from a girl. I'm out in Las Vegas, and this was in 2002, getting ready to leave out there. And I get a call from a girl, and she's over at a doctor's house that I knew, this doctor. She was very patriotic, the doctor was, and held meetings, you know, at her clinic and all this stuff. And I'd been there and spoke a couple of times. So she came, she was over visiting with her friend, the doctor from California. And I had my crime chart just to put it up on the internet. I didn't have an internet site, but everybody was taking it and spreading it, you know, because I could email. And they were parking up on their sites. And it was the three legs of Iran-Contra, I call it, which was Arkansas, Ohio, and Colorado. So she wants to have a lunch with me. She wants to treat me to lunch. She's got to see me over Robert Fesco being in the crime chart. Well, you probably remember some of the stories on Fesco, Chip, but Robert Fesco was tied heavily into all this stuff. He was a fugitive, you know, into security frauds and all this, and fled to the Caymans, and now he's in Cuba, it's reported. I don't know if he's still alive or not. But Robert Fesco was in my crime chart, because there were ties and overlays to Denver, once again, to the APEC-controlled Melman, the Israeli Mossad, the top Don, you know, the Silverado Bank, we discussed everything, my ex-in-law. So we had a long talk, and she wanted to talk further. And we were down the street from where I lived, and I said, well, let's go back to my place. We're sitting out on the patio, and I make a phone call to our mutual friend, Al Martin, Gene, and I make a friend to someone else you know that's a friend, and without mentioning names. And I said, why did Elvis Presley die, after she had told me this whole story? And they both came back with the same identical answer. It blew that girl's friggin' mind. And it was called Operation, I believe it was Open Pen. I'd have to go back to my notes on it, but I believe it was Operation Open Pen. And she was Bill Bixby, the actor's producer and assistant. And the girl didn't want to, her name ever revealed any place and all this stuff, you know. And but she was, they had made a 2-hour special on Elvis Presley, why he died, and you know what had occurred and so on and so forth. And she told me the whole story, and I even saw a video clip of it. And of course I then had made the phone calls and asked what was the name of the operation, because they didn't know. Well, what had happened is he went to Richard Nixon because of his concerns about drug a cartel in Colorado, and that he had stumbled across, you know, just being a singer. And so he decided he wanted to get a badge. He wanted to help put a stop. So they deputized him. What did it used to be called? The Bureau of Dangerous Narcotics and something what was the name of it? Gene, do you remember? It was before they changed it to the Drug Enforcement Administration. It's called the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, I think was what it was called. Well, he got deputized. Well, George Washington University had the actual documents up there and still do, showing that this is all true. And that, and even pictures of him in there with Richard Nixon and all the stuff. So they deputized him. And the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, I think they called it time or whatever their drug deal was, they deputized him. So he was officially deputized as an informant because he was going to help shut it down. Well, it turned out to be it was Robert Vesco's drug operation, which now is called Peter Kerr's, Neil Bush, and Larry Mizell's drug operation. They took over, which encompasses part of the boys in with Jeb Bush and so forth that I don't want to mention a name there because I was in jail with him. I'm not getting into that. Dangerous people. But the point is that, you know, I make the phone call, find out it's this open pen, and how they both explained to me what they had heard, how Elvis Presley died, that his colonel was compromised. And they had some stuff over, which was his manager, his handler. And he's the one that Elvis was taking some pills for something. And he turned around and slipped some other pills in. And he got a doctor that was Elvis's doctor involved. And they got him a little bit more hooked on something, a little bit more hooked, and OD'd him is what they did to silence him. Well, just before Elvis's death, Robert Vesco bought Elvis Presley's airplane with a hot check. And he actually took delivery. The check was supposed to be good on a Monday. He takes delivery on a Friday night or Saturday morning, whichever it was. They couldn't get to the bank in time. And, of course, the check bounced. And he had his airplane. Something that people don't know about. I might add, she was a little sweetheart.
If you say so.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Well, that was random. Thank you, Stu. All right. Okay. Moving on. So, celebrities, people on the inside, and also people on the outside who actually have a credible threat against the New World Order, global cabal, criminal syndicate, more or less. These are the people that wind up getting targeted for assassination. Now, I was just wondering, I mean, do you have any predictions of people that are alive today that you don't reckon will be alive too long there?
I'd say probably many of the heads of these large financial institutions are shaking in their boots. The head of J.P. Morgan needs to be shaking in his boots. A lot of these financial institutions, the weak links are being assassinated now, making sure that they're not going to roll over and testify. So they really need to be aware, and they need to get their eyes open and know that their whole institution and those under them are being looked at very, very heavily, and the decisions are being made on who's going to remain breathing.
Can I ask you, do they...
I correct him on that because I verified that the other day with a source on a throwaway phone that indicated that they've got the kill teams out there and they are assassinating. I mean, you just don't jump off of a friggin' skyscraper in London.
Yeah.
Okay, that's an example, but...
Or shoot yourself 9 times in the head with a nail gun. Come on.
Actually, it was 12 times in the head with a nail gun, 6 on the left side and 6 on the right side, and then ruled a suicide.
Uh-huh.
Wait, hold on a second.
Really,
let me.
Really depressed.
That's actually quite a funny pun there. He's shot six times in one side, 6 times in the other side, and that's called a suicide.
Suicide.
You know, I look at these bankers because they're the ones that were the scumbags that have put everybody in this. And, I mean, I got to list the names of these scumbags. I ought to put it up on the internet and say, hey, George Bush, this is the liability, you know, just to watch him get assassinated. Because, quite frankly, I don't care for these scumbags. They did this for money. I mean, maximized money and these huge bonuses. And they stole all these trillions of dollars. As far as I'm concerned, they need to be really locked up and used as witnesses, but nothing's going to happen. So, you know,
what I find absolutely amazing,
Go ahead.
What I find absolutely amazing is the fact that these trillions of dollars have left and no one knows where it is.
Yeah.
They can't find that money.
Yeah. Oh,
it's amazing.
Absolutely
well,
amazing.
If it takes 200,
who are they working for?
The corporations.
Well, if it takes $250K per ticket punched, and that was back in the 70s and 80s, it probably costs like upwards of millions nowadays to just do one hit. And because people are like dropping like flies all over the place, I mean, there's been so many bankers that have turned up dead just in the last couple of weeks alone. I think that's kind of where the money's going, don't you reckon? That's a fair assumption.
I'd say that's a part of it. I think that money is being saved and used in other areas. The money that they're using for this, look, every time we go into a war, we go into Vietnam. You can look at the history books. Look at Secord, Poindexter, all those guys. They had their arms sales business going. When the United States goes into a country, all of the arms, the only thing they bring out of that country are the aircraft. All of the small arms, all of the ordnance, grenades, law missile launchers, anti-tank weapons, tanks, vehicles, they're left in that country. Now, if you go back into those countries a few years later, you're going to see, well, where'd all that equipment goes. I'm going to tell you where it goes. Secord and the arms dealer, Hashiki and all of them, get those arms. They take them out to a neutral location, and they use all those arms in sales to other countries. And it's billions and billions of dollars. And that's the money they usually use for this type of operations. They take their cut, and then they have it in the kitty to take down. Now we have Afghanistan, we have Iraq, we have all these battles where all these arms are being made available and being slowly brought out. No one's going to question a C-141 or a C-5 full of arms leaving a country. And when a general is involved in it, it just goes wherever they want it to go, gets stored and then gets sold.
Yeah, that reminds me of a major who was stationed in Mexico City, American Air Base. He looked into one of these C-130 Hercules, I think, and there was like $1 billion worth of cocaine on board, and it was contracted to the CIA through the U.S. Forest Service, I think. And these planes from the Forest Service have been flown all around the world. You see them out of Afghanistan and Iran and so on and so forth, running drugs for the CIA. I've heard a theory postulated that the reason why the CIA is so heavily involved in heroin smuggling in particular, but also cocaine out of South America, is black budgets. If you've got all that money off the books, you can use it for your black ops, and it's untraceable.
Right. What happened in the 70s is the oversight and funding was taken over by Congress. So if the CIA or NSA or anyone wanted to do a black operation, they still had to go before these guys and get permission. And the problem is, when you tell a politician, if you lay a plans out to a politician, they can't keep their mouth shut. I'll tell you that now. They're going to call someone. They're going to tell someone. And so they decided we're going to make our own money machine, and we're going to run our black ops right off the bat. That's how I was paid. I was paid right out of the black ops budgets.
By the way, I can drop some in or not change subject, I want to read some of these names off, see if anybody recognize them. Just a few. Here's your bank bailout scamsters who sit there and created $100 trillion worth of mortgages that the government can't figure out, but yet I supplied this information. It's called Asset Investors Acceptance, Inc. These are all subsidiary companies of MDC Holdings in Denver, which is the parent company of Silverado, which is the APEC boys. Asset Investors Acceptance Company, Inc., Acceptance, Inc., Asset Investors Corporation, Asset Investors Equity, Asset Investors Finance Corporation, Asset Investors Funding Corporation, Asset Investors LLC, Asset Investors Mortgage Funding Corporation, Asset Investors Operating Partnership Limited, LP, BR Asset Investors Limited, BR Asset Investors LLC, DNR Asset Investors, Greenwood Asset Investors, LLC, Investor Asset Management Group, LLC, Investor Asset Management, LDC, MDC Asset Investors, 38 different entities underneath that, additional, and MDC Asset Investors, Inc. Now, that's one group of the names. Those were the ones that were creating the mortgages. And then this is just the partial list that I've acquired of the companies that are stealing everybody's houses back that are these artificial mortgages. Aurora Loan Servicing, Inc., of course, Colorado Corporation, run by myself, Bank of America Corporation, Countrywide Financial, Bank of America, Back Home Loan Services, LP, Countrywide Home Loan Servicing, LP, Bank of America Mortgage Securities, Inc., Bayview Loan Servicing, LLC, Caliber Home Loans, Inc., Veracrest Financial, Inc., California Reconveyance Company, Carrington Mortgage Services, Chase Home Finance, LLC, City Mortgage, Inc., City Residential Lending, Inc., AMC Mortgage Services, Inc., Home EQ Servicing Corporation, Barclays Capital Real Estate, Inc., HSBC Mortgage Services, Inc., Lender Processing Services, Inc., Litton Loan Servicing, LP, Nationwide Title Clearing, Inc., OCWEN Loan Servicing, One West Bank, Orion Financial Group, Inc., Securities Connection, Inc., Select Portfolio Services, Inc., Wells Fargo Home Mortgage, doing business as American Servicing Company, etc. Now, those are just a few of the big ones that were involved and still are involved in the mortgage fraud, folks. And a frigate government with 250 federal agents and 30 and 50 some odd attorneys, including SEC attorneys, can't figure this out. Now, if I can figure it out, why can't the following SEC attorneys and the U.S. attorney in Denver, one's name is, here, I'll give you their name.
Can I just postulate a theory before you continue? How come they can't figure this out? You need to turn your speakers down.
Yet they can't just simply take the trail and go figure it out. Instead, they want to settle for $13.5 billion with J.P. Morgan and never prosecute anybody.
Mm. Well, either it's because they're on the take or they're afraid of getting assassinated.
Yes, exactly. Mm. And we have to ask ourselves who Eric Holder, if anybody remembers scamster Mark Rich, and, of course, Eric Holder's assistant up there that resigned last year, because Frontline did several specials on him about the cover-up of these mortgage frauds, and he decided to take a hike. That was Lanny Brewer, I think his name was. He took a hike from the Justice Department knowing the heat was coming down. Both of those two, Eric Holder and Lanny Brewer, were Mark Rich's attorney. Did you ever do any business with Mark Rich, Chip?
No, I didn't.
I wanted to ask Chip a question, and your speakers are up again still, Stu. Can you just turn those down because there's still a bit of feedback? Chip, has there ever been any assassination attempts that, contracts that you were a part of that were called off? Right, like they were stopped or anything like that? Because I was wondering if they want you, they'll get you. But what if you know that they want to have you, and what if you approached the people that would take out the hit directly and go, guys, I know that you're probably going to try and kill me and what have you, so I'll tell you what, I'll leave my position, I'll zip the lip, and I won't be any problem for you whatsoever, just please don't kill me, please don't hurt my family, and I'll do whatever you want. Is there anything like that? There's no negotiating with these people, though, is there?
No, well, that's the process. The process of neutralizations normally begins with negotiating with them. They'll try to negotiate with them. If that doesn't work, they'll try to intimidate them. If that doesn't work, they'll try blackmailing them. If that doesn't work, that's when they send us in.
Okay, so it's like three strikes, then you're out.
That's it.
You know, literally out of the park. Okay. Well, it's funny because I came to. Hold on, Stu. I came to a similar conclusion about that. Is in fact, I've had a couple of people approach me and say, Vinny, aren't you afraid that they're going to assassinate you? And I go, no, absolutely not, because they're not just going to, like, straight out assassinate me if they want to, all right? First, they're going to approach me, negotiate with me, then try and blackmail me, and then intimidate me, and if that doesn't work, then they'll kill me. So I've got plenty of warnings before I even get to that point, so I'm not really worried about it.
Well, there's a story out on the internet. One of the interviews I did, I think it was with a radio host in Fort Lauderdale in the 90s. After the interview, he was approached. A couple men in a Cadillac drove up, knocked on the door, got him outside, and told him if he ever did a radio show like that again, if he ever had me on, he'd be underground.
I think I remember that one. Wasn't that the one that Jeb Bush lost the election that year?
That's the one.
We were pounding him on a radio program down there, and Jeb Bush had this stooge female on another radio program on another network, and we would come on Sunday night, many of us, and pound Jeb Bush and all his crimes. And the next morning, Monday through Friday, this girl would be there supporting Jeb Bush, I swear. Jeb Bush was standing outside the radio station every day with the zipper down. You know, he was just so proud of this woman. And so anyway, she never could put him back. And he was totally destroyed and actually lost the election. I remember that, Gene. I remember that.
And now we have Jeb's son, George Prescott Bush, coming into politics. This year he's running for office in Texas.
And people say this.
Four.
Yeah, and people say that the United States isn't a monarchy. You know, you've got your royal families just like the rest of the world, don't you?
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. I was just thinking, is there ever going to be another president who's not related to the other presidents? You know, and in fact, there was this 14-year-old girl who did a genealogy thing just in high school. You know, 14-year-old American girl managed to figure out through genealogy, just tracing back the mother's and the father's lines, that every single president since the frickin' the very first one have all been related by blood in some way, shape, or form.
Well, the way Stu thinks, everybody is. Adam and Eve's the mother and father, you know?
Yeah, especially if you...
I don't know what I think anymore.
Yeah. Well, see, in America, you make... Adam made Eve out of baby back ribs instead.
Give me that baby back.
Huh? I want my baby back ribs. Okay. Now, conclusions and what have you. I think you've lived a very interesting life there, Chip. Have you got any, like, philosophies and things of that nature? You know, real interesting lessons of life that you think are probably worth sharing.
Sure, don't go to work for the government.
I mean, that's a given. That's not important philosophy, you know. It's like, you know, by the way, you know, one of my important philosophies is not to work for criminal psychopathic scum, you know. It's just like, really, okay, dodge that bullet, so to speak.
I've learned in life that you can trust no one. And I really mean that, because when you're down, even those who you thought were your friends are going to pull away from you, even family members. And when you're down, you're going to find out who your real friends are. But don't put your trust in anyone. Don't feel like you can open up to anyone about anything you've seen, or it's better you just keep your mouth shut and walk away from things.
And if you want, and I'm in agreement with what he said. And by the way, Vinny, if you go around telling people, like Gene, would you say what he did for a living, or if you go around like me, I know as a whistleblower, what do you do for a living? If I say a whistleblower, I don't get laid. But if I say I'm a home builder or I'm a contractor, oh, well, then there's interest. I'll leave it as that. You know, everybody runs for cover.
Yeah. That's actually true. You know, me try and tell girls that I'm a talk radio show host, and they just back away slowly, you know. It's like kryptonite to vagina. I'm joking.
It's worse than that when it's on your
whistleblower. Yeah. Well, plus I'm married and what have you. And there's the other element as well. I had James Wright. He's a Freemason whistleblower. He was like right up the top of the 33rd degree Supreme Council in Dallas. And I asked him one time, don't you feel kind of like lonely? You know, like he hadn't been in a relationship for ages. It's like as soon as you tell somebody, "Hi, I'm under threat of assassination constantly by the Freemasons," they're like, "Whoa, I don't think that's worth it." You know?
Yeah. Well, I don't have any luck either. What do you do? Well, I'm a retired spy. Oh yeah, I've heard that before, you know. And this guy over here is a neurosurgeon. You know, they never believe it, so you never hit it with them.
Yeah,
you just say I'm retired, or I run an electronics company right now.
Yeah. I exterminate people, you know.
Insurance company.
Yeah. I'm in genocide insurance. You know, I work for the government.
Company, right.
Yeah. Isn't that strange though? I mean, come on, ladies. Don't you have? Where's your sense of adventure?
You know, when we work for our proprietary companies, some of the companies we work for and maintain IDs and everything was Xerox, because we could travel worldwide with that. Another one was Melita Coffee Corporation, believe it or not, out of Germany.
Yeah,
that gave us tickets to go anywhere in the world where they were, you know.
So you can get Xerox off.
Yep, there's a.
I'm beginning to believe another friend of mine, you know, in one of the agencies, and he's a super spook. Gene knows who he is. He says there's no substitute like a prostitute. I said what? He says, oh yeah. He says you got a good looking housewife someplace. He says, you pay her $200. He says, you spend more than that on two or three dates trying to get laid. Then you finally get lucky. He says, I don't have to put up with the crap. He says, have a couple drinks with her. Have about 3 or 4 hours of great sex and send her the hell out the door. And I don't have to tell her I'm a spy.
Yeah. Right? Hey, well, where there's a will, you can get your end away.
Yeah, I'm just making fun of women out here because they're the biggest wimps that there really are. But you know what's very interesting? In this Patriot movement, in my opinion, there's probably 7 women to every 1 guy. I mean, to the 7 to the 3. There's probably 70% of the Patriot movement are women. Why? They're constantly pushing the men to do something. They're constantly pushing the men. The men, the protectors, to do something. But yet the men don't do it. They'll finally get them off their duff to do something. I've seen that. There's 7 out of 10 in this Patriot movement want to clean this up are probably women. And I give them high regard and high respect for that.
Well, I actually, I'm gonna have to go ahead and sort of disagree with you there because I've had a look at the demographics and things like that, visitation to my website and a number of other Patriot websites. It's actually the opposite. It's 30% women, 70% men.
I could show you what mine are showing. I mean,
That's just because you're hot, Stu, you know, and the women just want to come and look at you at your website, you know. That's what I'm betting. And the other element here is I've spoken to a lot of guys who are in the Patriot movement and spoken to their missuses and whatnot. You know, missuses, it's a plural of misses. And what happens is the women are actually the ones who hold the men back to a large degree and or hold them up, okay? So the men go out and they're doing all of this stuff kind of thing and that they start to go a little bit crazy, then the women rein them in. Or the men will go out and do stuff and start being really successful, but they'll start to be trepidatious about it or what have you, and the women will help them and support them and keep them going kind of thing. Or at least these are the relationships that I've spoken with a number of Patriots about. It seems to be pretty much that way. If they're in stable relationships, other than that, if they're single, you know, it's basically you're on your own.
Well, do you think we've got about 50 million people that would just go to Washington and round everybody up and round up all DHS across the land and just, you know, we can put new people in position right there. Hey, so-and-so out of the crowd, come over here. You think we got enough people to do that?
I don't know. It depends what
there's
position.
There's only a million of them that are locked and loaded and armed. There's 100 million people supposedly locked and loaded and armed in the United States. I'm not suggesting overthrowing. I'm not suggesting revolution. I'm just asking, are there enough men out there with the guts to finally say yes?
Well, here's another thing I've found, is that finding a woman, if you're a patriot and you expose scumbaggery for a living, is actually quite difficult. Like, I've spoken to a number of, say, for example, fluoride activists and what have you, guys who just, you know, can't find a girl because whenever they... I mean, it's really stupid. Okay, you're trying to make the girl like you by talking about the fact that they're dumbed down and their fertility's being threatened by fluoride. You know, it's like it's like a self cock block. And I thought about this: what if there were women who were already into the fluoride debate and what have you? What if we started up a dating website for them called Fluoridate.com?
There you go. Believe me, I don't have any problem picking up women any place. It's just when you tell them you're a whistleblower, they run the other way. So I've learned not to do that.
Yeah.
I lay low, real low, all the time. I have to.
Yeah, if you lay low, you get laid.
Well, no, I'm laying low. I'm acting, you know. I've got little toys, and I've learned how to rig up door handles. Come through my door handle, you get electrocuted, other things, so... You know, as a contractor, you learn to do things.
That reminds me of a friend of mine. We had there's these alarm systems where you put them together and they don't make a noise. And you're supposed to put them on doors and stuff. So as soon as somebody opens the door, it goes. You know, like really, really loud, right in the ears. And we installed it on the fridge, and we were just waiting for our mate Timo to go to the fridge and get himself a beer out of it. We got it on video as well. He's just like, whoa, what the hell is that?
Hey, you know, Radio Shack sells at Home Depot and all those places. You can buy them for $150, Radio Shack. But Radio Shack's got this little portable for all those women out there in these apartments and guys that might be concerned or whatever. You know, they got a little motion detector device with a little horn on it. You used to be able to buy it for $25,
$30. Hey, hey.
And, believe me, they make a hell of a lot of noise. That door pops open.
Maybe Planned Parenthood. Yeah. Whichever knob you're talking about. And maybe Planned Parenthood could actually benefit from this knowledge, you know, and encourage people to turn whistleblower because it'll reduce the amount of reproduction that goes on.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Hey, it works, doesn't it? You know, you can't argue with progress.
Whistleblower or spy, right?
Yeah. I think that'd be the way to go for it. I think, and that way you don't have to chemically poison people with the fluoride in order to make sure that they don't have babies. I don't know. It'd be more humane, I think. But I could be wrong. Now, anyway, this kind of descended this conversation into a very dark place. I didn't think it could get darker than it originally was. But
have George Bush neutered and all their entire family. Castrated and neutered? I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
Don't have any more generations of this crap.
Yeah. But then again, there's all these bloodlines and stuff all over the place. So you'd actually have to have quite the long, protracted campaign of castration and neutering and what have you.
With all their money, there's always insemination.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Cloning.
Yeah.
Done that in 91, too.
Mm.
Daddy Bush and Milman and the Kissinger and all of them, all the council went and cloned 25 times over. And they cloned it and cloned it in a test tube and they took an egg out of one woman. They turned around, put the egg back in and the whole bit. But the word is that they got 25 clones each and they're all over 20 when they're, this is all done in 91. So that, figure that out, 91, 22, 23, 24 years of age.
In 2004, Stu, in 2004, when I was in Cuba, I visited one of the largest genetics labs and most advanced in the world. It's amazing what they're doing there.
Yep. They got a stem cell out there in Santa Ana, California, And that was all financed by the Milman Group. And here's what I understand about the stem cell. What their ultimate goal is, this is what I understand, Gene. We haven't talked about this. But I understand that the reason that they clone themselves is because they figure that they will, 20 years from now, up now time frame, old men in their 80s, late 80s, and that they could take and transplant their brain eventually when they die off. They're going to have it transplanted into one of their clones. And this way they can live on. And the stem cell is to make sure that when they attach the spinal cord to the brain, that's what all the stem cell research has been about and the perfection of it. This is what it deals with. And this is the reason they were plotting and planning way back then. Well, you know, I would love to see Leonard's brain transplanted into something younger and retarded, okay, and half crippled. But I still want to see that ghost down there in Cuba before, you know, he ever has the opportunity, that ghost, to transplant his brain.
Well, the project, they call it, is Project Zeus.
Zeus?
Project Zeus.
Stu, again, your speakers are too loud, man. Feedback. All right, there you go. Sorry, what were you saying? Project Zeus?
Project Zeus.
Can you elaborate on that?
The psychiatrist, who was a friend of mine that took me to the genetics lab, just took me in. He said, "This is our our Zeus project that we've been working on for years to help." He said, "With this project, we should be able to cure most diseases, most cancers, and in addition to that, we're well along a cloning timeline." So,
he took me in,
showed me strands of DNA, tried to explain everything to me, but. You know, remember, I flunked that chemistry exam, so.
What's the big deal about Cuba? Why are they all hiding out of Cuba, Gene?
Well, it's the one place that you'll never extradite from, for one thing. As long as you have money and you can pay Castro his ransom, you know, you're safe down there. And I'll tell you, Cuba's nice. I enjoyed it. Doesn't matter if you're a whistleblower in Cuba. The girls will still go out with you, Stu.
I guess that's kind of like called a Cuban extradition.
Well, I was gone for 10 years, and where I went was Colombia, and I lived in Colombia. And everyone talks about the dangers of Colombia. Listen, Chicago's more dangerous than all of Colombia.
Well,
New
that's
York's
because
more dangerous than all of Colombia.
Well, that's because they're gun ban zones, and they're run by the mob, who also run the cops.
Well, and... Well, down there, everyone's got guns. I mean, it's just known. And drugs are legal now. An ounce of cocaine is legal. 23 ounces of marijuana is legal for personal use. So, you know, and it's so cheap anyhow. If someone wanted it, you know, a whole kilo of cocaine down there, 97% pure, as well as only $500. So if they wanted drugs, they were there. Now, the reason they keep it safe there as they call us extranjeros, they're foreigners, is because all the tourist areas are run by the cabal. And they have huge investments there, and the last thing they want is for these tourists to have any problems.
Yeah. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to donate a plane ticket to the Vinnie Eastwood show so I can go to Colombia and, you know, just do some deep research. Go for your life.
Medellin, Vinny.
Or I want to go kill a ghost.
No. I'm just joking, by the way. No, actually, well, I wasn't joking. I'm very serious.
I still have a house there, and I'll be going back down.
Okay. Excellent. So I have a place to stay. I won't have to spend any money on a hotel, and I can spend it all on drugs. It'll be fantastic. You know, in fact, wasn't Bush and a number of other the elite and what have you, they're setting up these big sort of safe houses, compounds and things of that nature in South America? Like they want to get out of the United States when this alleged martial law FEMA camp crackdown and what have you happens?
Yeah, they've all invested heavily in Uruguay and Paraguay in the southern portion of South America. Very, very, very. Good cost of living there, but they have huge holdings down there.
Do you know any details of that, or is it just kind of like
mostly large ranches, fincas?
Well, you know, I think that's the bush way, isn't it? You know,
go big or stay home.
Go big on a ranch and spend about 9 months out of every year of your presidency on holiday.
Well, I don't know why someone had to ask George W. Bush, because he has arrest warrants out of The Hague right now, red notices, international court for war crimes. So does Dick Cheney, and so does Gonzalez of Texas, the former attorney general, and so is, I think, Scooter Libby and a couple others. And a couple other attorneys that were underneath him. I can't think of the names, but Boyle, one of the professors out of the University of Illinois, if you go to that website, or go to The Hague International Court, they've been indicted, folks. This was like a year and a half, 2 years ago. And they got red notices on them. I don't understand why George Bush, someone just doesn't snatch him, you know, some good guys in our side of our government, take him to international court and just drop him off at the doorstep.
That's how it happens on these international warrants, Stu. Unless they're actually listed with Interpol, and normally they aren't from The Hague, no one will stop them and do anything. So they actually have to be listed with Interpol. And who controls Interpol?
Daddy Bush.
Yeah, I love it how the fox actually builds the hen house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's not just guarding it. He actually, you know, got a hammer and nails and constructed this up. And just like, Frank, there's some chickens that I can trap in here and eat, you know, and control the whole damn thing. Ah, here we are. Yeah, I have the ability to create money out of thin air and ship drugs all over the place. And you know, hey, these people operate with absolute immunity and impunity, don't they?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. What can you do? What can you do? And it's
move to Colombia.
Yeah. Clearly, because you'll have enough cocaine that you won't mind that you can't do anything about the scumbags that run all the cocaine. Yeah, that sounds about right, actually. Okay,
you know, I like Bruce Campbell's idea, and he's a former mercenary. He knows who Gene is. Probably worked a couple of operations, Rhodesia. Rhodesia.
Rhodesia.
Probably dropped him over there a few times. But Bruce has a solution. It's called the AmericanDefenseParty.com. And their solution is for all Americans right now, and I've been pushing this, if we get involved in what we call the American Defense Party, which is three basic things people need to do. One, set up your neighborhood crime watch. You say, oh, we already got a crime watch. Well, you got six or eight people reporting back to the local police on all their neighbors. That's not a crime watch. I mean, a true crime watch where you got people once a month volunteering for 2 or 3 hours that make their career of duty to drive the streets. But to watch each other's back. By setting up the crime watch, going around with a piece of paper, you know, a few flyers, you know, to all your neighbors, you're setting up your crime watch, you have the opportunity to meet your neighbor. You have the opportunity to educate your neighbor while you're setting up the crime watch. Because one of these days, we're going to have a situation happen in America. What do you mean? Well, You watch TV? Well, yeah. What channel you watch? Oh, you will watch the Israeli news channel. Do you ever get on the internet? Start talking about Veterans Today. Talking about Vinnie Eastwood's show. Start talking about Gene Chip Tatum or Stu website. It gives you the opportunity to wake up your neighbors. Now, second part is to set up what's called the police oversight, citizens oversight committees. And you go to your city council with all your neighbors in your city, and you push it all over, and you get enough people up there to demand that you have oversight, civilian oversight, citizens' oversight. Now, there are set up across the nation, several of them in several localities across the nation. The idea is a cop gets out of hand, brutal with someone, shoots or kills them, beats them up or whatever. Someone files a complaint or family files the complaint. Guess what? If they find the cop guilty, he immediately is suspended, fired, and immediately prosecuted by the local prosecutor for violating that person's civil and constitutional rights. And it puts a stop to this brutality. You know, our police forces are being trained and have been for the past 10 years by the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces. They're going over there taking police training. They've got this mentality like they do in Israel. You just kill them. Hey, they're the enemy on the streets. Now, there's an article by Preston James on Veterans Today. It's in the slide deck up there, the picture changer. It's about the third or fourth one over. You might take a look at that, the last one by Preston James. He's a psychologist, and he defined it perfectly on what's going on with these police departments. Well, that solves that problem. Then the next thing is to reach out to your local politicians, your local police themselves, and the people inside the military and so forth that you know, and start getting them patriotic. Make them understand, because so many people are sitting around watching the TV. And I say recall petitions. There's the reason I set it up. Three people have been removed in Congress. Out gun control nutcases out in Colorado have been pulled out of office in the past 6 months. And a friend of mine, Victor Head, needed help. I helped him. He gave us the boilerplate. Everything's there. If they violated their oath of office, signed the Patriot Act, the NDAA Act, indefinite detention or gun control nutcases, all you have to do is pull the boilerplate off, go file the Secretary of State's office, look at the video on how to do it, go get the required signatures. Now, here's my offer to anybody listening. If you file and get your filing done on who you're going to go after, congressmen and senators on the state level or federal level that have violated their oath of office, I will get you on. I will put a story about you and your efforts to recall on Veterans Today. And I will get you on local TV or local radio in your area. And I will get you help and support in getting those signatures. That's my offer to anybody. Because it's 99.999% of the Congress and Senate is bought and paid for by AIPAC, which is the same ones that are Daddy Bush's partners. And they're the same partners to Bibi Netanyahu that have overthrown this country. And we need to get back.
Now,
solutions for the average person out there to go do. Simple and sweet. Get off of the internet, get off of Facebook, get off all these alternative places where you're posting the stooge land stupid crap, and you're being fed by these stooges that are trolls that are working for DHS and Mossad and all the others. I mean, the Israelis are going around hiring kids that are Jewish kids, Israelis, into colleges and paying them $20-$25 an hour to come take off their disinformation off their disinformation sites. Rat-faced Jews is a perfect example. Before It's News is another example. Alex Jones is another example. Rumor Mill News is another example. I'm going to start outing all those that are traitors to my country. It's time that we start shutting them down and shutting them off and start getting in the streets and really doing something.
Now, you mentioned having oversight committees, all right? Now, in my experience, every single oversight committee that I've seen in session and trying to investigate crimes and what have you, it seems that the role of oversight is to just overlook all the crimes that get committed.
This is civilian oversight. This is you setting it up and you being on the board and civilians that are not politicians or anything else. And if your city council says, hey, screw you know, we're not going to upset the apple cart. That's what recall petitions is for. Now, they've set police oversight committees up. Go to Bruce Campbell. He'll tell you about the other districts where they've already been set up. Okay? We got to go on the local level. We don't have long. I hear by the end of the year, they're going to start flying the drones. And when they start flying the drones over America, Daddy Bush, they're going to start zapping a lot of people. You're going to be
they're flying them in Tampa.
Pardon me?
They're flying them in Tampa.
Well, they're flying them. They've got them 2 to 3 feet long coming off a Boeing assembly plant, 50 a week. And they're going to use them on people. And that's what this new NSA base is in Utah, in Bluffdale, Utah, is all about. With an alien base connected right next door to it that runs all the way south down to Richfield, Utah. Okay? Ask yourself, why is that?
Yeah, well, Americans, if you thought that America was, like, so full of drones walking around in the streets or whatever, you ain't seen nothing yet.
You haven't seen the party. At the end of the year, the party's going to start, and you're going to be sitting there on TV, and all of a sudden, nobody will see you again.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, you know, it really puts things into perspective. Yeah, it really puts things into perspective when your popcorn gets popped by a Hellfire missile.
If they can pop the World Trade Center towers with that death ray, I call it, with a nuke that was on the 80th floor that they know about, and they can melt that sucker down like they did, disintegrated. What do you think they can do with you?
Mm.
Think about it.
Yeah, and as you've said before, you know, if they want you, they'll freaking get you. But you get warned first, and what have you? Just like the Israeli shipping company that moved out of the Twin Towers a week before 9/11 and broke their lease. You can't make this stuff up, ladies and gentlemen. Hey, and another thing. We're talking about the JFK assassination, right? I was talking about this with my guest yesterday, and it reminded me of something that Bill Hicks said. You know, Bill, quit talking about Kennedy, man. You know, it was a long time ago, you know. Can't you just forget about it? And he goes, okay, well, then don't bring up Jesus to me. I mean, as long as we're talking shelf life here. You know, Jesus died for your sins. Yeah, I know, it was a long time ago. Forget about it. Why don't you get Pontius Pilate to release the frickin' files? You know? Who else was on that grassy Golgotha that day? Now, finally, and we've only got a few minutes left in the broadcast. Man, that just wasn't funny, me reiterating it. Bill Hicks is a lot funnier than I am. conclusions. This is the thing. I mean, what should people be watching out for? Do you reckon, because of the information that you know, you've actually really lived your life much, much different to how you would initially speaking? You know, like, people are always walking around so innocent, and they think that nothing's going to happen to them, and what have you. And their lifestyle doesn't change when they hear about this kind of information, because they think, oh, well, you know, I'm not one of those targeted individuals. What's the difference, and what have you. What would you say to somebody like that? Should people be living their lives any differently? Should people be doing things any differently in their daily life as a result of knowing that there are teams of incredibly well-trained killers out there that pop off people who are a threat to the New World Order agenda?
Well, their whole standard of living is going to change. And if they like, in the meetings in Jupiter, we talked about Americans being controlled by the U.S. military, by police. But Bush flat out said, look, boys, as long as we keep food on the table, a roof over their head, and they're just going to be fine. Gas in their car, they're going to be fine. They're complacent. Americans are complacent, and as long as we keep them that way, there's nothing we have to worry about. What they have to understand is, if they'll look at themselves, they don't have as much food on the table any longer. It's much more expensive. They don't have that security of a roof over their head. Homes are being taken from them. The gas price has gone from $2 upward to $3.50 and $4 a gallon. All those are slowly taking away from them. And what that does is it's slowly separating the wealthy from the middle class. And the middle class is moving down more toward poverty. They have to realize, they have to open up their eyes. Whenever I end a program, I ask him one thing. This is Chip Tatum. Is anybody out there?
What about you, Stu? What's your advice for people who think that because they're not targeted individuals, they really got nothing to worry about and don't want to really change their life and how they live it?
They're fucking idiots, because everybody's targeted, right over the TV, right over the internet, right through the phones, the cell phone, and the ground line. And if you think you're some special, oh, I'm a targeted individual, I belong to this group, or oh, I'm being targeted over here. It's because you're sitting on your computer posting on Facebook, you're targeted. They can mind screw you. Veterans Today has done two stories about this in the past 3 months, how they can take over a person's mind. And one of them came out after the Naval Yard shooting, when they proved this guy had been mind controlled between the TV, the computer, and the cell phone, and it was the Israelis who did it. And had him in there shooting everybody up because they wanted to pay back our U.S. military that stopped the war in Syria. Okay? Now, if they could do that to that guy and make him a mind out of control nutcase, going around shooting and killing everybody, what do you think they're doing to you on Facebook and on Twitter and all these other places that you're posting your garbage all the time, or you're sitting around looking.
Oh, join me in Bejeweled.
Yeah.
Well, by the way, I need to finish up this interview and start playing some more Candy Crush. And posting, yeah. And interestingly enough, posting the link to this interview.
You got a revolutionary song that could just mind scrum, you know? Hey, you listen, I call it mind rape. I call these alternative stooges in the media mind rapers. They're like screwing with baby patriots' minds, you know? They're like pedophiles. They're pedophiles of their mind to control them and all. That's what they're doing to you when you're going out here and you're on the internet, on the social medias, because you might see 8 out of 10 things that sound good, 2 out of 10 don't. Maybe those 2 out of 10 might be the truth, but there's really probably only 1 out of every 1,000 up there that's real true. Now, I'll tell you something. You'll find truth on Gene Chip Tatum's website. You'll find truth on my website. And you'll find more truth right now on Veterans Today than any site in the world. That's the reason it has become the number one alternative news site, and it is mainstream news media. You will see things pop on that site within a week. It will hit mainstream media at times. And then they'll try to actually spin it from the truth. It's getting that very popular. We got 2 million people per hour at times on that site. We've done this in a year.
Well,
everybody needs to be coming there. They need to be coming there because these are FBI agents. These are military intelligence officers. People like Gene, who's been there, done that. We, you know, almost everybody in some way or form, fashion, is working for the government or not. He's not. I'm not. Preston James isn't. And a couple others aren't. Basically, the others, yes. And what do they have behind them that they're bringing to the plate? About 5,000 agents' information that's being released weekly.
Mm.
People need to understand this. There is a movement to clean this country up, and in order to do it, you have to educate the people. They have to understand where to come to get it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's best to hear it from the people who have been there and killed that. So, thank you very much, gentlemen, for your time and your knowledge and wisdom and various other nice things today. And it's been a nice pleasure and an honor. And I'm going to go to the bathroom and evacuate my bowels because it scared the living bejesus out of me.
Well, hey, don't listen to Alex Jones now. He doesn't change your diapers.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have the documents.
I'll see you later.
It's admitted. It's on record.
Yeah, and also, ladies and gentlemen, there is the Alex Jones drinking game. So if you are still listening to the Alex Jones show, is whenever he uses the word, it's admitted, it's documented, or I have the documents, or it's on record, you take a drink. I can guarantee you within 30 minutes, you'll be pissed as a skunk. Thank you very much, gentlemen, and thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for supporting this show all of these years that I've been around. I do need your support now. We started off the week with a $900 shortfall in the rent, the power bill, and also my wife needs to get her car registered so she doesn't get pulled over and get a frickin' $700 fine by these fascist police in this country. And we've got about 500 so far in donations to cover all of the costs this week. So if you're capable of help supporting us and popping an extra 400 in there, I'd be very, very much obliged. You don't have any idea just how much. Thank you very much.
Don't forget, Godfather Vinny here is running a special fund over here to exterminate certain New World Order people, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. By the way, if you do want your donation money specifically to going to hiring assassins, then donate through the PayPal and you can put little notes on it and stuff like that. Vinny, this is into the assassination fund, and I'll create a little account or something like that on it. It'll be fantastic.
Go. Remember?
I'm serious, though. All right. Thanks, guys. Have a lovely day. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. You are the only
Don't you-